On this episode of Skeptico.
Everybody in the UFO community, everybody's into this Rodney Dangerfield thing. We're the Rodney Dangerfield of all sciences. We need some respect, and people will bend over backwards, lie, do whatever they got to do to try to get science to come on board. They ain't coming on board. The National Academy of Sciences is only 4% of people in the top 2,000 scientists in the National Academy of Sciences who believe in any sort of paranormal phenomena. Only 7% have any experience in God. Forget them. We have to do this ourselves. We cannot try to appease them because they're the ones that are holding this thing back. They have this materialistic worldview that they are not going to change. You and I are different because we're not scientists. We don't have any vested interest. We're not going to lose our grants. We're not going to lose our job. We can say whatever we want. But these people are in this box that they cannot get out of this box.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Segaris, and on today's show, we welcome back acclaimed UFO researcher Grant Cameron to Skeptico. Now, one of the things I really like about Grant's work is that not only is he incredibly thorough, and is he somebody who's really read just thousands and thousands of pages of documents culled from presidential libraries and government sources that are just beyond what most of us could even imagine. But he's also someone who's been open to looking at the bigger picture of what might be going on. And I think, as you'll hear in this interview, that plays out in a number of interesting ways that intersect with many of the topics we normally talk about here on Skeptico, including consciousness, near-death experience, psychedelic experience, all that stuff. And at the same time, what Grant brings to the table is this kind of rock-solid documentation about the reality of the extraterrestrial phenomenon. And I just can't emphasize that enough because, I mean, we all do still live in a world where you have to kind of couch this stuff carefully and watch the facial expression that the person you're talking to is having when you even mention the term UFO. One of the things I take away from Grant, and I really want to emphasize in this show, is that's total bullshit. I mean, we have the kind of governmental documentation of the reality of the UFO ET phenomena that most people who study secret government programs could only dream of. The documentation is clear. The authenticity of the documentation and the people involved is clear. It just couldn't be any other way. And yet, we still have to talk carefully about UFOs because we don't want to look like one of those people who've stepped over the crazy line. So this is quite a long interview. I've pulled out some pieces and published them on YouTube, or will be doing that if you look in the next few days. I hope to do more of that, gather some video, and see what else I can do with some of this content. But it's a long show. It's worth it, I think, sticking around because Grant has so many, many great points. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with UFO researcher Grant Cameron. Today we welcome Grant Cameron back to Skeptico. Grant has been recognized by his peers as not only being one of the top UFO researchers in the world, but also one of the most thorough. I mean, here's someone who's filed literally hundreds of Freedom of Information requests. He's visited, he'll have to tell us, but dozens and dozens of archives, presidential libraries. I mean, physically made appointments to go to some obscure presidential library and dig through documents. That's what he does. So here's someone who's read thousands of pages on these topics, countless interviews with insiders that we would never have a chance to talk to. And that's what makes it such a real treat to have Grant on. I always learn a ton whenever I hear him talk, and I'm sure we will today as he talks about his new book, The Clinton UFO Storybook, Extraterrestrial Politics in the White House. Grant, awesome to have you back on. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, Alex, I appreciate being on. As I sort of mentioned to you before, your podcasts are very important to me. I recommend them all the time. And I think that of all the podcasts I've done, of all the interviews, I think you're the closest to where I'm at in my mind as to how does reality fit together, the whole idea of consciousness, what's important, what's not important. And I think I agree with you totally on the science aspect, which I spend a lot of time, how science has handled the world, how it's sort of messed up things. So I very much look up to the interviews you do, and I can quote a lot of the people you've talked to and a lot of the interviews you've done as to having influenced me as to where my thoughts are going.
Well, that's really cool, and I hope that plays out in this interview, that we have this kind of working in a synergistic relationship, because that's certainly how I feel. You've shaped so many of my views on UFOs. So let's start with the book, this new book, because I have a ton of questions about Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, Nelson Rockefeller, and a lot of other stuff. But what I was hoping you could do to kind of start folks off is, before we get into all of that, just give folks a brief overview of what the book is about.
The book is basically about the Clintons. I, as you know my story, I had a sighting, a number of sightings in 1975. The publishers were not interested. In fact, the one publisher said, "Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers." And I became very frustrated with sightings. I figured this was a total waste of time. And all I was really interested in is what somebody must have the answer to what I'd seen. Somebody must know what I saw. And I started this pursuit going up through the Canadian government, through the former president of Penn State University, and then up to the presidents of the United States.
Grant, can I interject something here? Because I've heard this story a bunch of times, but it always kind of gets me every time I heard it. And that's the story in 1975 of these encounters. Because what the visual that I always get when you tell the story is, you're driving around with your buddies saying, "Hey, let's go watch the lights, because we know they're going to show up." I mean, everyone in town is seeing them. They're in the newspaper. They're on TV. People are going, "What's those strange lights? What's those strange lights?" I mean, this is different from the kind of UFO sighting that most people think.
Yeah.
They came, everybody saw them, and then they went away. Can you, again, I know you've told it a million times, but tell that story?
Well, in fact, as I said, I can never recall having had an interest in UFOs. I had an interest in Edgar Cayce, psychic, that kind of stuff. I had an interest in near-death experience. I'd done a study when I was at university with dying patients. But when I went to see the lights, the only reason we went, because this thing was like viral in the local media in this city of 700,000 people where I live. But when I went out, I said it was like buying the lottery ticket. And you buy the lottery ticket, you know you have a chance to win, but you know you're not going to win. I had no expectation whatsoever of seeing anything. I figured everybody else will see it. We're not going to see anything. And in fact, we had driven around in the town, out of the town. It was a town called Carmen, Manitoba, which is about 25 miles north of the North Dakota border. And after an hour, my friend said, the guy that was driving said, "Okay, we're going to go back in town one more time. And if we don't see anything, we're going home." Said, "It's fine with me, man. This is a total waste of time. I have no interest in this at all anymore." And it was like I just believed, like there was a chance, but we're not going to see anything. And as it was coming in, we had been driving around, and sometimes you have these sky watches where people go out and they look for stuff, and people are saying, "Well, you know, what's that up in there in that part of the sky?" And so that's what we were doing. And I had no background in astronomy or anything like that. So we're looking at stuff. It was planets and stars. I don't know what it was. And I'm saying, what is that, what they're looking at? And is that what they're doing? And I think, well, whatever they're looking at, it's not very impressive. We didn't know what they were looking at. But when it appeared, it was instantaneous. There was three people in the car, and it was instantaneous. Nobody said, "Well, is that what they're looking at?" It was just instantaneous. There it is. Everybody just instantly knew this is what they were talking about, because it was just so bizarre. It was so so close, and it came right in front of the car, and it was like a pulsing plasma type object that was moving. It was bobbing up and down. It wasn't even going in a straight line. It was bobbing up and down. It was coming right in front of the car, very low, very, very slow, flying across the road. And it was just, it just absolutely changed my life. I couldn't get enough of it. And that's when I drag all my friends out two nights later, and they give up after an hour. They say, "Okay, we're going back to Winnipeg. We've had it. We're hungry." And I was so, it's almost like the expression that you have when you're dealing in the UFO field. Almost nobody is ever on your side, like your relatives, your friends, nobody's on your side. And that's what happened. All my friends, and they've never really sort of backed me on it. They had their chance, and they left. And about 15 minutes later, two nights later, the thing came right at us the second night. And I was just so amazed that, you know, I saw this thing coming at us, and then it was sort of moved and it sort of flew off into the northeast. And I can still remember back, this is 1975. I can think back, I'm thinking, wow, that could be somebody from another planet. And I'm going like, what are they doing? Because it didn't make any sense. They were just sort of just flying along like they were burning gas. They didn't seem to be going anywhere or doing anything. And I just sort of fell off the edge of the world. I mean, I started, you know, talking to people and figured this is the most important thing I've ever seen in my life, because there's a difference between hearing somebody else's story and actually experiencing it yourself. So I was so blown away with this. And then when I'd done all these interviews and done this, you know, 300-page manuscript, and nobody was interested. They just had no interest whatsoever. And that's when I sort of got very sort of down on the sighting aspect, that I can tell you my stories, and I had one that I almost jumped on, and, you know, I was so close I could jump on it and stuff like that. But it's still just my story. And I was still just enthralled to try to figure out who knew. And when I got to the president of the United States, I figured, well, he's the most important person in the world. He's the most powerful guy in the world. And I figured, well, what does the most important person in the world know about the most important subject? And what I found in going to the library.
So this you saw as a vehicle to kind of propel your story onto a larger stage that people might be interested in, right? Because you did your 300-page manuscript, you talked to your friends, you recognized, you had the insight, the reality check that this is the most important issue, period. So you were trying to figure out a way to kind of elevate it up to the level that you...
Well, it wasn't so much elevated. It was almost like the quest. It's almost like you have the quest where you're trying to figure out what is reality. What's it all about? Because I was raised in a very religious environment. I was a very young kid. I was preaching in church, and I was supposed to be the next big minister and this sort of thing. And that was sort of my trajectory. And then I sort of dropped out of that. But I had always had this thing of what's ultimate reality? What's really going on? Most people sort of go through their life, it's like the expression, most people live lives of quiet desperation. And I've always lived a life where I realize we're coming from somewhere and we're going somewhere. And I've always been enthralled to try to figure it out. That's why when I went to do this research study at the hospitals, and this is in the mid-1970s, this is when near-death experiences first came out. And I went and I had all these weird questions because, I mean, that fascinated me. Like, where do we go when we die? So I would ask these questions like, well, do you ever have anybody in your – and I would go not to the doctors and not to the nurses, because they always had this vested interest in protecting, you know, what they were believing in. I went to the chaplains because, you know, when it comes down to the end of life, there's no BS. I mean, it's game over, and the chaplain's there. Nobody's telling jokes. Nobody's making up stuff. It's for real. So I went to the chaplains. It didn't matter whether I went to the Roman Catholic nun, who was one of the chaplains, or whether I went to the, you know, the Protestant or whoever. They all said that basically the same thing. And so I'm asking them questions like all the weird stuff that interested me. Like, do you ever have any miracles? Do you ever have anybody get up at the last minute and they're about dead and they get up and walk out of the hospital? I said, do you ever have anybody, you know, near-death experiences just coming in? The first books were coming out. So I'd asked about near-death experiences. I asked about these visions that later on my father would have when he died, these visions where, you know, the day before their person dies, suddenly someone walks in there, you know, a dead relative comes in and greets them and gets them ready. And then I would ask, the other question I asked is, because Edgar Cayce had predicted his own death. So I said to them, I said, do you ever have anybody predict their own death? And there was piles of stories of people who, you know, and the chaplain would say to the guy, for example, the one story, the one guy had this is before cell phones, this is before internet, before all this kind of stuff. So the guy's there, and, you know, before you die, you have this one really good day, like a cancer thing, where suddenly they become very good. He's having this good day. His wife is there, and she leaves him about 9:30 in the morning. She's going to go shopping. And they said, she just barely walked out of the hospital. And suddenly he said, and the chaplains are always told, if anybody ever says this, you call the chaplain. Don't call the doctor. Don't call the nurse. Call the chaplain. So the chaplain gets a call, and this guy's saying, I'm going to die. He goes in. He says, well, what's the story? And the guy said, you got to get my wife back. I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. And so the chaplain says, well, okay, we got to find your wife because, I mean, there's no cell phones or anything. And where'd she go? Well, she went shopping. So they're trying to figure out where she went. And he said, well, how do you know you're going to die? And the guy said, I don't know. I just know I'm going to die. Today's the day. I'm going to die. Get my wife back. And they're trying to calm this guy down. And so the guy says, well, how do you feel? Do you feel something different? And he says, no, no. He said, I feel something funny in my legs. I feel something funny in my stomach. I just know I'm going to die. Get my wife back. And so finally it's like, I think it was 2:30 in the afternoon. They finally track his wife down, get her back to the hospital. 3:30 in the afternoon, the guy's dead. So there's these kind of stories that just fascinated me, that sort of intrigued me with the UFO thing when I got going on that. But it was on this overall thing that we're coming from somewhere and we're going somewhere. And the other thing that sort of drove me in my whole career was that Edgar Cayce had said, knowledge not used is sin. It's fine for you and me to know what's going on, but if you don't actually put it out to somebody else, then this is a sort of a, you know, something bad. And the other one was, because I was raised really religious, I remember the expression, to whom much is given, much is expected. And then, of course, I studied Dr. Michael Newton, who does 7,000 regressions, and he takes these people and lets them die in a past life. And they go in front of the council, between 3 and 12 people do the council. And Newton says, everybody says the same thing. When they get there, they're asked the question, how did it work out? Because you're the guy doing the play, and you're wanting to do certain things, and everybody says the same thing. I could have done better. And that's what Newton said. So I've always been driven by this thing that it's so fine for me to figure out the answer. So I'm driven to get this answer. And I get up to the president of the United States. I figure, well, here's where the answer is. And I couldn't find any documents in the library. That's the first thing. But after working on it for about 30 years, I came to the conclusion that the president knows. The president knows what's going on, but he's never going to tell you.
Let me jump in there I want to pull out one more story for you, because I haven't heard you say this. And I'm interested in what it was like for you when you began that research, because that's a great backstory to understand your personality, your upbringing, and how that brought you to it. But I think most people stop when they hit that brick wall, or when they hit the second or the third brick wall. You must have pushed through a lot of brick walls. What was it like for you at the beginning? You sent out your first FOIA request. What was that like? You sent out your first, you know, what was that very early on process like for you when you decided, okay, I need to get serious about researching this?
Well, what had happened was we were chasing this Dr. Eric Walker, former president of Penn State University. He knew the whole UFO thing.
Why were you chasing?
Well, what had happened was when I first gave up on the sighting thing, and you get these synchronistic events that happen in your life. One of them was that my father was a pilot for the Department of Transport here in Canada. And one of the radar technicians in his office had actually had a sighting in this area, this small town thing. So he said, well, Ernie Epp has this sighting. He wants to talk to you. And so I go to talk to this Ernie Epp guy, and he says, you know, he tells me the sighting. It's just, you know, an ordinary sighting. He saw something flying around, whatever. And then he says to me, he says, you know, if you really, and this is this real weird synchronicity, where he says, you know, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should study with the Canadian government. And here's me on this search. I'm trying to figure out, like, what's the ultimate answer to this thing? If you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should study what the Canadian government used to research. Wilbur Smith ran the whole project, and I worked for him. And I said, you did? And he said, yeah, he was the smartest guy I ever met in my life. And he said he was the smartest guy, but he was crazy. I mean, he was talking to aliens, and they were landing in his backyard. And I went, he was the what? And I couldn't believe this. He was telling me this bizarre story about this guy. And he turns out he's a contactee. And he's the guy that ran the Canadian government UFO program. So I'm still very young. And that gives me my next opportunity. So I give up on the sightings and I buy a plane ticket and I fly to Ottawa. Wilbur Smith, who ran the Canadian government program, by then was dead. He died in 1962. This is like 1977 now. And I interview his wife. And she's secretary to the Speaker of the Senate, very high level herself. And she's retiring within the week. And so she's ready to talk. And she starts telling me this story about Wilbur Smith and these contacts with the Canadian government. And they had contact with this alien and they're going to land it at an army base in Canada, and the involvement of the prime minister. And it's like, she's talking about her dog. I mean, it's like just affa. And she's talking about this alien. I'm going like, wow. It's like, I was just sort of blown away. So I gathered all his material, and in collecting all that material in 1978, I think one of the most significant documents ever released in ufology is released, and that is a document where the Canadians go to the Americans in 1950. This is when it's first starting. 1947, it gets going after the detonation of the atomic bomb.
Okay, Grant, let me stop you for a minute because I want to make sure we really nail this down. We've talked about it before, but I just feel a need to really document what this document is, where it came from, why you know it's real, and kind of those kind of details.
When I start this process at looking at the Canadian government, we discover this document that is declassified in 1978. And this, I believe, is the most significant document in the whole UFO field, because there's absolutely no doubt that this document is legitimate. It's in the archives in Ottawa, in the Department of Transport files. There's copies, there's draft copies in Wilbur Smith's files, the guy who wrote the document. I talked to Dr. Oman Slant, who's mentioned in the document, and the only objection he had to the document was, well, Wilbur Smith didn't have authorization to put top secret on the document, to which I replied, well, how do you do it then? What, does he send it in by the mail and let somebody determine what it is? I mean, he has to put top secret on the document. You can declassify it right away, which is what they did. They moved it down one step below. But what happens is Wilbur Smith is running the Canadian government, and then they call the Flying Saucer Program. And Wilbur Smith never used the word UFO, ever. He always used the word flying saucer, flying disc. And what happens is the Canadians are interested, and Wilbur Smith has these ideas for propulsion. So he's a high-level radio operator, a radio engineer, the top guy for the Department of Transport. He goes to the Americans, and he's talking through conferences, and they're negotiating FM radio stations across the border and stuff like that. And he talks to people, and he says, I suddenly find out that it's a bunch of smoke. And where there's smoke, there's got to be fire. And he starts digging in. So what they do is they go through classified channels. So they get a guy by the name of Arnold Wright, who was a military liaison in Canada. They go through the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C., and he goes through classified channels and talks to the Research and Development Board in the United States, which is the part of the Defense Department that actually builds the weapons, builds the atomic bomb, the hydrogen. They were, at the time, they were working on the hydrogen bomb. And he goes through there, and according to what Wilbur Smith got, the file comes back, and Wilbur Smith writes this document and says, we've talked to American officials, and they have told us the following items. Flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States, rated 2 points higher than the hydrogen bomb. It's of tremendous significance to the Americans, and there's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. She was the science advisor to President Roosevelt. He's the guy who worked on the proximity fuse, the atomic bomb, radar, jet engines, plastic explosives, all those inventions of World War II. Vannevar Bush was the guy that ran all those programs for the scientific side. Then there was a military side that ran the other side. But he was the main guy. And now Wilbur Smith identifies in his document that he's running the program. And then this thing that comes into my later download in 2012, which I wouldn't realize until 2012, was the next line in the document says, and we were also told by American officials that other things might be associated with the flying saucers, such as mental phenomena. And the Americans aren't doing very well because they've said to us, if we're working on a program, they're willing to exchange credentials and talk to us. Now, the key part to that is that now we sort of know aliens are telepathic. Do you have contactees, experiencers, abductees? All these people are talking about these aliens being telepathic. But in 1950, the first abductees would not be known until Betty and Barney Hill's book came out in the mid-1960s. The first contactees who said, you know, they got for rides on flying saucers and stuff like that would not appear until about a week after the detonation of the hydrogen bomb. Suddenly all these people appeared. But in 1950, there was nobody in the public who was saying, I'm talking to aliens and aliens are telepathic. So the question is, how did the Americans know to tell the Canadians in this top secret memo that mental phenomena was part of the phenomena? Because, you know, you just watch the lights fly around the sky. What do you know? You can't tell what's going on. And what I think now has happened is we now realize that during the Roswell crash, one of the aliens was alive. Because there's a number of people now have testified and have actually said that they were in the room with the alien when this alien was captured, and that the alien was talking in their heads. So to me, that's a significant part of the UFO thing that a lot of ufology will leave out, is this mental phenomena thing. Is it's fine to say it's highly classified because of the metal and how the thing flies, you know, the anti-gravity, stuff like that. But it's even more significant that in 1947, on day one, when this thing starts, they realize that there's this mental phenomena aspect. And they realized that we would learn later, that I can talk about later in the interview, is we now know that's how you fly the craft. You use your mind. That's how it's done. It's done with the mind. So you have this mental aspect phenomenon first started in this document. So what happens with the document is I'm trying to figure out, once we recovered the document in 1978, it's declassified. It goes through a number of stages. It gets downgraded in 67, then 78, it finally gets declassified. And I think by accident. I don't think they ever would have released this document if they'd known what was in it. So they declassified the document, and I start looking, who are his sources? Because it says American officials. I'm trying to figure out, who did he get this stuff? So we're following this trail, and we come across a guy by the name of Dr. Robert Sarbacher. And Sarbacher is being interviewed in 1983, and he mentions the fact that there's a set of briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where in 1950, where they had brought in a bunch of engineers, scientists to brief them as to what they had discovered. And he couldn't go. He was too busy. So when the interviewer is asking him, well, who went? They would mention Vannevar Bush, von Braun, the famous rocket guy, von Neumann, one of the key guys that started to invent computers in the early days and did a lot of quantum physics stuff. He's mentioning all these guys. And so the Stanton Friedman, who was doing the interview, said, well, you're mentioning all these guys. They're all dead. Is there anybody that still might be alive? And that's when he said, well, there's this guy in Pennsylvania. He had a lab like me, and he was very arrogant. And he thought he knew everything. He went to all the meetings, and we tracked it down, and we discovered that it was probably Dr. Eric Walker, the former president of Penn State University. We go back to Sarbacher, and Sarbacher says, yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy. He went to all the meetings. And Walker was high level. He worked engineering studies for President Eisenhower. Milton Eisenhower was the president at Penn State before him and actually appointed him vice president. So he's very close to the Eisenhowers. He had 14 honorary doctorate degrees. He was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, the top military think tank in the country. And it goes on and on. He was the assistant secretary of defense, this big high-level guy working on weapons in 1950. And that's the time when this briefing took place, when he got invited. We contact him and we say, we just heard the guy that was doing the interviews in California, and he says, I've been informed that you attended a series of briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base dealing with the recovery of a crash flying saucer and dead alien beings. And Walker said, yeah, I was there. So what? And a guy went, what do you mean, so what? He said, there's the MJ-12, and there's this group called MJ-12, and I've got this document. And then he cuts him off. He says, look, I've known of them for 40 years. And he's referring to MJ-12. I've known of them for 40 years. And this interview took place since 1987, which would have been 40 years back, 1947. I've known of them for 40 years. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do. You're up against the windmills. You're wasting your time. And that he would never want to talk about it. He said, can't talk about it. So for 8 years, we chased this guy around. And we're trying to get him to talk. And he likes to play little games. He'll, you know, write letters back and put little comments on the bottom of the letters and stuff like that. But he really's not saying anything. He's just talking in rhymes and riddles. And he's sort of playing around with us. So we know he's got this file because he's dealing with about 8 researchers. And he's sending this stuff. So I know there's this file. I go to Penn State University after he dies. And I look through his massive collection, 100,000 pages of material. He was Penn State president for 15 years. I get all this material. And I'm looking for UFO document. I'm looking for this main UFO document where he's dealing with us, hoping there's going to be a bunch of stuff in there I haven't seen before. And I'm looking for statements that he would made about UFOs. And I did find a couple where he talked about how, you know, the environment, we've destroyed the environment. And even if the aliens look for us, they couldn't find us because we've destroyed things so badly. But I couldn't find it in Penn State. Then one of the letters in Penn State said that his military stuff from Research and Development Board, he was going to give to the Truman Library. And that's how I ended up at Truman Library. I didn't plan the president thing. I went there looking for Walker's files. And when I went there, they weren't there. And it was at that point I figured, wow, I wonder what they got on UFOs. So that's when I asked the archivist, I says, well, what do you got on UFOs? And he said, well, this is Truman's library in Independence, Missouri. And you remember in 1952, they have the overflights of Washington, D.C., which really set off the whole thing to get to the bottom of this thing. And they have the first night of the Saturday night, the things are flying over. And the rumored story was that Truman gave a shoot down order. And what happens is in the library, you have all these telegrams coming in to the White House saying, don't shoot them down, Mr. President, because it was all over the newspapers in the United States that there'd been a shoot down order. And then they appear the next Saturday night, and that's when they scramble the jets and they can't catch them. So they got these documents. I go, okay, and there's maybe 20 pages of different faxes and stuff or telegrams. And then there's really nothing else. And I'm going, this is kind of strange. I mean, you know, this is the most powerful guy in the world. This is this subject where he was flying over the White House and you hear all these rumored stories and there was nothing there. So this is very close to the Eisenhower Library, which is in Abilene, Kansas, which is about 2 hours away. So I figure, okay, I'll go to Eisenhower and I'll find out what's going on there. And it's when and Eisenhower, it's like everybody's wearing the ties and the suits. It's like a really formal type place compared to any other library. And it comes from that age. So I go there and you have to actually interview. So I interview to research and they ask me and I'm kind of embarrassed at the time. It was like, what do you interview? Well, it's sort of like, you know, and I sort of get it. And the guy's actually very good about the whole thing. And he comes back and he's got they go through the search and they got 5 documents. And I said, well, how many pages have you got? And he said, 28 million pages of files. And they got 5 documents. I'm going, something's wrong here. I mean, and that's what made me like, I got to figure out what's going on here. And so I started this search through the presidential libraries to find out where these documents are. And eventually we learned that probably it's there really are no documents, because Eisenhower's guy that he brought in to be his advisor on the Air Force, 1948, there's an actual oral history, which is one of the things that really interests me at the libraries, because when I go to libraries, there'll be no documents. So I would sit there and read oral histories, which is like, Alex, you're like the cook at the White House. And you leave the White House, and then they come say, Alex, what was it like? Did the president ever come at 3 o'clock in the morning? And they ask all these weird questions. And I used to love to read these things. And in one, the guy who was the Air Force advisor to Truman actually says that he was called in February of 1948, given his job. And one of the first jobs he got was to brief the president orally on the UFO subject every 3 months. So he would have given like 15, 16, 17 briefings till 1953 when Truman left. So already in 1948, they already knew, don't write it down. Just give me it orally. And they knew how to keep the secret. So that's where I realized, but it was still interesting to go to libraries and to look at like Reagan's speeches and to see, you know, like the alien invasion remark and actually look through the speech files and see how the drafted and who said stuff on and how did it get in the speech and stuff like that. So I was kind of interested, and I did this search, and that's what led me to the Hillary Clinton book, is I'd done the Clintons. And what happened, I got lucky with the Clintons. Somebody had filed when Clinton was still in, and when the president's in, there's only basically one part of the White House that's not exempt from FOA, and that's the Science Advisor's Office. All the other agencies inside the White House, you're not allowed to see the documents until 5 years after the president leaves office. So the president gets 5 years after he leaves office. He can work on for his memoirs or whatever he wants to use the documents. And at that point, as soon as the 5 years is up, it's first come, first serve. So if you file FOAs, first day, you get all the whatever you want. So what happened was when he was in office, I went through the science advisor and I filed for all the UFO documents and I got 991 pages. And then when I filed some appeals, it was like way over 1,000 pages of documents that mentioned this initiative by the billionaire philanthropist, Lawrence Rockefeller, who's got the philosophy degree from Princeton, he's a business guy, but he's got this, you know, this humanitarian side. He's into the ecology and he's into UFOs and stuff.
And hold up on that story, because I want to treat that separately, because it's a really important story. But go ahead and continue.
But anyway, so I get these 1,000 pages of documents, and I really don't realize the significance of these documents. Somebody else is actually convincing me. These are very significant documents. I go, they're kind of interesting. And there's nothing blacked out, not like ordinary government documents. There's nothing blacked out. This conversation is going back from Rockefeller to the science advisor. And even when I found the Hillary Clinton documents in there, it still didn't click on me. But what happened was, as soon as I got all these documents, then President Clinton leaves office. 5 years later, his documents become open for public, and I've got all the names. I know who is all involved, and I start filing like 100 FOIAs on Webster Hubble and Rockefeller and Hillary and all this sort of stuff. And all this stuff gets in there. It gets into the library, and out of the first 18 FOIAs out of the Clinton library, 11 of them were the UFOs. And then suddenly it went viral. Associated Press, Washington Post, Fox News, and everybody wanted to know what's with the UFO stuff at the Clinton Library. And I basically said, well, it's first come, first serve. I knew when to file the FOAs. And so I got all this material, and I put up a Hillary Clinton website when she ran the first time around, and she didn't make it. Then I pulled a Hillary Clinton website because there was really no news. She doesn't really talk about the subject. But what made me do the Hillary Clinton book is I had done all this material and I'd written articles on what I found in all these documents and the great interest that Bill and Hillary have in this subject and in all sort of new age paranormal stuff. They're very spiritual minded, you know, new age type people. So I wrote all this stuff and I had it on my website. And then this year, John Podesta makes this thing and says, talks to the reporters and says, talk to Hillary about the aliens. She gets asked this first question in New Hampshire, and she just blows me away.
So hold on a minute. Let's treat that separately too, because you have a lot to say there about John Podesta and about how disclosure might happen, why, and all the rest of that. So if we can we just kind of put that off for 1 second. Here's where I'd like to take you next. And it's kind of in a different direction, but that might be good, because then we won't, it'll force you to kind of start all over. So in your book, in your latest book, The Clinton UFO Storybook, one of the things that jumped out at me at the beginning is you start with this introduction by Edgar Mitchell that was actually written for another book that you had. But it's stunning in a number of ways. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, for the folks who don't know, who is Edgar Mitchell, how you came to know him, how he came to know you, the story behind that, and then why this introduction is written the way that it is, what it means to us.
Okay, well, Edgar Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon, and he, again, had this sort of a new age look at the world. He wasn't sort of cut off by the way science is cut off.
Yeah, and he claims that was a direct result of his experience as an astronaut, and during that time, it kind of was a transformative experience, and that opened him up, right, to kind of...
He has the ESP stuff, and then he has this oneness experience, which to me is the key. It's the key alien message. It's the key mystical message. It's like the key message. It's this oneness thing where he's coming back to Earth, and then suddenly he gets overwhelmed by the fact that he suddenly realizes, and he knows it for absolute certain, that everything is one, that he's connected with everything in the universe. And this is the download experience I sort of got in 2012, that came with this absolute certainty. So when Edgar Mitchell's talking about this absolute certainty, it's not something you got to question. It just comes to you, and you know for a fact this is true. So he becomes interested in this sort of aspect of oneness, of ESP, and he starts asking questions because he's actually born in Roswell, New Mexico, which is a bizarre synchronicity. And he starts talking to the old timers about whether this thing's for real. And he talks to the Roswell people, and they confirm, yes, this is for real. This is these high-level people are telling him. And I believe that he may have got somebody in the White House to actually confirm to him. But he would never identify who these people were. And he was famous for helping Dr. Stephen Greer, who was one of the people in the Clinton administration, who was trying to get people to talk. And Edgar Mitchell was one of his supporters and attended a number of briefings that they had with the Defense Intelligence Agency guy, the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, some very high-level people. And Edgar Mitchell's in these meetings where he's trying to enforce this thing. And Edgar becomes a believer. He believes this is for real, and he encourages people to try to get to the bottom of this. And what happens is that I'm writing this book originally on exopolitics with Stephen Bassett, and we're doing all the presidents. And he's at that time, he's very involved, and he writes this forward for us.
Go over the key points in that forward, because, again, if someone's kind of well-versed in all this and knows the million of the Edgar Mitchell astronaut stories, UFO interests, it's old hat. But I thought the way that he very directly spoke to these points, I mean, I'll just recap them for you and then you can say them. I'll edit out my part. But the space program created a consciousness shift for all of us, for society. When we went into space, it created a consciousness shift. Number two, that anyone who investigates will conclude that we're not the only game in town. It's obvious to anyone who looks. Three, overwhelming evidence that we've been visited continuously for a long, long time. Four, there's an ongoing campaign of misinformation, distortion, and lies to hide this information. And then five, this is not good for civilization. That's what I pulled out of it. But you tell me what you felt like he was trying to say in his foreword and why he was saying it the way that he was.
Okay, because I haven't really read the foreword that many times. So, I mean, you picked out it more than I did. I didn't really pay much attention to it. But Edgar Mitchell writes the foreword, and in the foreword, he basically talks about the fact that anybody that investigates this will find out that this is for real. This is a legitimate situation where we are being visited by some sort of non-human intelligence. And he makes reference to the fact that consciousness is linked to this whole field. And that is something that will later come out to me through my download and will come out through the foundation that he establishes. He establishes this free foundation where this is one of the key aspects is actually this consciousness aspect of the whole thing.
And the important thing about FREE, the FREE organization that we've spoken to the folks a couple times, Ray Hernandez and Mary Radwell a couple times on this show, is the focus is on experiencers, which is the other shift in this that comes about when you start thinking about it in terms of consciousness, in terms of its connection to the mystical, extended, spiritual experiences. Then you immediately shift away from the engineering aspect of it and the craft aspect of it, and you switch into thinking about the people aspect of it and the experiencer aspect of it. And it sounds like Edgar Mitchell was ahead of the curve in making that shift a long time ago and saying, we need to look at the people who are being contacted and having this experience.
Yeah, he had had contacts with experiences before and actually had this healing experience where he'd been healed many years before. So he was sort of in that world where he realized there was more to this than just nuts and bolts and metal and this sort of stuff. And he's pointed out what a number of people have pointed out is that there's a lot of misinformation based upon his experience of going through defense intelligence and all these different briefings that they did, that there's a whole series of lies that has been established by the control group, whoever's running this thing, to keep this thing withheld from the people. And that is very important. And this is an idea that John Podesta will bring out later, is that this is a very important subject for people to know. And the way John Podesta would frame it is that you cannot run a government. You cannot run a democracy unless the people know what they're voting for. And that the advantages of releasing this outweigh any sort of disadvantages that might come from losing some sort of technology to the Russians or the Chinese or stuff like that. That is very important that this get out. And Edgar pushed this, and he tried to support people who were trying to get this message out, realizing that a lot of effort had been put into trying to keep this stuff secret.
And that is that, Grant, there's a good chance that Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president of the United States. You think that she could be the first president to disclose the truth about UFOs. Why?
I think that Hillary Clinton may be the first president ever to disclose exactly what's going on. And she's given a number of indications that indicate that she's the person that's going to do it. For example, when she was talking to Damon Steer, she actually pointed out in 2007, when she was asked about UFOs, she said, I'm very interested in that. And she said, do you know that the most requested item at the Clinton Library has got to do with UFOs? And that's what sort of dragged me back, because I was doing consciousness. I wasn't interested in the presence anymore. And I got dragged back in because I thought I was banging my head against the wall. And suddenly here's the first lady, this woman who's probably going to be the next president, actually knows that the most requested item in the Clinton Library is UFOs. And she actually told somebody about it. So I'm thinking that drags me back in. But she has made a number of statements that indicate that she's going to do it. For example, there's a story, and I fight against it in the book. I write a whole section at the end of the book, a long section of the book, which says, does the president know? And a lot of people, most people in the UFO community will say, no, the president's a puppet. He doesn't know what's going on. There's nothing going on. And so one of the main people that was putting that story out was Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton says, you know, I tried to get this material and I wasn't able to get it. And I'm embarrassed. I tried to get it. And he plays this denial role. There's a government inside the government and I don't control it and all this sort of stuff. And I'm just like this puppet guy. So when Hillary Clinton is asked, when she's on the Jimmy Kimmel show, you can see she's got a prepared answer. He proposes the president doesn't know. He said, well, I had your husband here on the show and I asked him about this. And you said you're going to release it, but I asked your husband and he said he didn't know. So what do you got to say to that? And she starts the answer and everybody starts laughing. So she stops the answer, waits for the crowd. And then she goes right in there and says it with no hemming and hawing. She says, well, I'm going to do it again, or I'm going to look again. I'm going to do the investigation again. She's very authoritative that she's going to do this as if like this is planned. And that indicates to me, when you hear Bill talk about it, it's, well, we really don't know where to go. And the other thing, that there's a number of other indications. John Podesta has talked about it a number of times in his, every time the story seems to stall, John Podesta will come up and he'll say, she takes a look, she'll have the material in front of her and she has to decide what she can release. And he's talked about it before. You have to weigh national security versus unthinking secrecy. This is what he calls it, unthinking secrecy. So he's not saying she's got to go and find the Wizard of Oz. She's got to find the evil cabal to find out where the documents are. He just says she has to look at the material and disclose as much as you can. And then when Hillary talks about it, she also says, I'm very interested in this. She's talking to this New York City radio station. She says, well, if I can, I get the material. She said, if I can get agreement and it's not national security. Now, the important part is if I can get agreement, which means she knows what the process is. She doesn't say, I've got to find the Wizard of Oz. I got to find the evil cabal. She says, if I can get agreement, which means that she already knows how the process works, and she's going to have a meeting with somebody. I don't know who it is. A group of people are going to meet, and they are going to make the decision, which makes me think that maybe in 1947, say if it was the MJ-12, the 12 guys that run the show, this elusive, you know, theme group, it was 12-0 in 1947. Then it was 10-2. Then it was 8-4. Then it was 6-6. And now it's 5-7. There's actually the vote is to say, let's move it. And that's what I've heard from the inside. I've talked to an experiencer who has a number of high-level people chasing him who are that's the way I work. These are the most important people in the world. They've got the answers. They're dealing with whoever these people are, this force is. And this guy has high-level people around him, and he showed me a contact to Barack Obama. I couldn't believe it. He's showing me his photographs, and I went, whoa, I suddenly realized, like, he's actually got some sort of contact with Barack Obama. What he told me that he had been told by people who are dealing with him is they want it out. They're just trying to figure out how to do it. They don't want the government's fingerprints on it, which almost fits into the Podesta thing. Podesta's going to take the fall, and he's going to force this issue out. Rather than the president standing up and making the disclosure announcement, they come in through the back door and they force this thing out, which almost like if you, for example, with the Iran-Contra, where you're going to get some guy's going to salute, somebody's going to resign when this thing breaks, he's going to take the responsibility, the president didn't know, and this thing will come out. So they're trying to find a way to get this thing out, because it's like the British thing leaving the EU. Whatever happens, this is going to be like 10 times what happened to the EU. It's suddenly like and I say there's going to be two disclosures. There's going to be the disclosure, number one, that we're being visited by ETs, however they want to frame it, but the second is the big disclosure. The second is the consciousness disclosure, because as soon as this thing gets disclosed, they're going to say, okay, there's aliens coming here. And the number one, if you take a look at scientists, the main people who are stopping the disclosure is science. It's not the media. It's not the government. It's science. Scientists say this is garbage. You believe this, and it puts this sort of toxic touch to the issue. Nobody wants to touch it. Scientists, you know, media doesn't want to touch it. The government doesn't want to touch it because nobody wants to get, you know, burned by this issue. So when the disclosure is made, then the number one question that science says is they say, this is impossible. You cannot get here from there. Time and space, all day, you know, go through all this stuff about you can't go past the speed of light and all this kind of stuff. So the number one question that's going to happen after it gets disclosed that ETs are here is, how the hell did they get here? And that's when it comes down to this download that I got, where I was given the answer, where I had these three things, the top secret memo, this thing, mental phenomena is part of it. Then we're talking to Dr. Eric Walker, and we're asking Walker. This has popped into my head, this conversation I had in 1991. I had no idea what he was talking about until 2012. Have this download comes into my head, and I suddenly say, oh, that's what Walker's talking about. He's asked a question about the control group, MJ-12. Is it still just 12 people, and is it all Americans? And he says, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? Which, like, what has that got to do with it? It's got nothing to do with anything. And the guy didn't have an answer, and he said, look, unless you understand about ESP and how it works, you will not be taken into the control group. Very few people understand how it works. And he drops it. I don't figure it out until I get this download, and suddenly, oh, now I know what he's talking about. And it was almost like something put all these pieces together and put them all together. And the third one was even more spectacular. It was 1993, 2 years later. Ben Rich, who's the president of Lockheed Skunk Works, which has always been rumored inside the UFO community to be the company, the aerospace company that's back engineering the saucers. He's giving a lecture in UCLA to the engineering alumni at UCLA, March of 1993. There's three researchers in the room. Ben Rich stands up. The last slide he shows is a flying saucer. And he says, we now have the technology to take ET home. And everybody laughs. Everybody thinks it's a big joke, and the lecture ends. And a bunch of people start asking him questions. He said, we've discovered the mistake in the equation. It's not going to take a lifetime to do, but it's going to take an act of God to get this thing out of Congress because it's so deep black. One of the people in the audience, and this is where you come down to these experiences, how important it is these people have had experiences. One of the people in the room is Jan Hartson, who's now the international director for the biggest UFO group in the world, MUFON. He's the international director. He has an experience at 9 years old with his brother. His brother drags him out of the bedroom. There's somebody trying to get into my room. Somebody's trying to crawl through the window. They go out into the backyard, and here's this flying saucer, 30 feet away in the backyard. And they're already fascinated with UFOs. They're trying to build a flying saucer. And suddenly he said, well, maybe, you know, he read an article, maybe flying saucers come to where they're doing research. And he said, well, maybe the flying saucer will come. We're trying to build a flying saucer. And sure enough, this flying saucer appears in the backyard and he tries to go in, he gets the camera, whatever. And this thing takes off and he becomes infatuated with UFOs his whole life. He becomes an electrical engineer just to find out how UFOs are, the propulsion system works. So when Ben Rich is leaving, he asks all these questions. He's leaving the building and he said, this is my chance. I've got to do this my whole life. And he goes to Ben Rich as he's leaving the door. He said, Ben, I've been fascinated with the subject my entire life. I need to know, Ben, how do they get here? How does the propulsion system work? And Ben turns around and says exactly what Walker said 2 years before. Let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And Jan said, I didn't expect a question. And he said, it means everything in time and space is connected. And he said, that's how it works. And he walks out and gets in his car and drives away. And that is how it works. It's this thing that they're not flying through space. It's like an entangled particle type thing where you take one particle on one side of the universe, one particle on the other side. You change the spin of one and the other one instantaneously changes. That's what I believe is going on. It's this mental phenomena thing that they're moving it around. And then that gets reinforced, as I said, by the Edgar Mitchell group, where 14% in this big free survey done of all these experiences, people who claim to have had interaction with these aliens and their experiences, 14% of all the people are claiming they've flown the craft. And I remember the first time I thought it was crazy. The first time I ever experienced this was 2013. I'd been working on UFOs for like 37 years. And this woman suddenly says to me in Phoenix, Arizona, after I give a lecture on consciousness, that she's flown the craft. And I went, you what? I couldn't believe it. I was just floored. I said, you flew a craft? And she was like in her 70s. I said, well, how do you fly a craft? And she said, you do it with your mind. And at that point, I started to gather these people, realizing these are important people. I started gathering, I got 36 people. And I tell, most of these people are women who fly the craft. And as soon as a woman will say, oh, I've got these dreams that I'm flying the craft, I say, stop it. I want to ask you a question. How do you fly a craft? Nobody has said anything different. Everybody says the same thing. They don't talk about little joysticks. They all say the same thing. You do it with your mind. And so that comes to this aspect that this mental phenomena thing is extremely important as to how this whole phenomena is working. And it then ties into all sorts of other paranormal phenomena. So what I say now, it's all the same thing.
But I'm going to back you up for a minute. I have a long question, but it's the Skeptico question here. I got a couple of Skeptico questions for you. You just mentioned it there briefly, but you say it repeatedly in your book that the president of the United States is the most powerful person in the world. And you also say they are the good guys out to help the nation the best they can. Now, you don't deny the human failings of our past presidents, be there George Bush or Bill Clinton or any of the rest of them. You know, all that's been documented. You don't deny that. But you conclude, I think, as you've said, that after reading thousands of these documents and going to the presidential libraries and reading documents that sometimes, in some cases, they never thought would be disclosed or other people would never see or read, you get the sense that these really are good people trying to do their best, even if they don't always do their best. So I respect where you're coming from, but I have to wonder that if we look at the evidence, we might come to a different conclusion. And if we did come to that conclusion, what would you think about it? So let me run through a couple of points that are on my head, and then I want to get your thought on it. Number one is, and you've touched on this, but the president doesn't know. So when Vice President Harry Truman was sworn in 1945, and you said you went to his library, he was briefed for the very first time on the Manhattan Project, the project to build the nuclear bomb. He didn't know anything. He's the vice president. He's the number two man. He knows nothing. There's 100,000 people at least in the United States who are working on this program. There's dozens and dozens of people at a very high level who understand the whole thing. And yet it is compartmentalized in a way so that he doesn't know anything. But it's not just the don't know thing. It goes a lot deeper than that. And that's my second point. And that's just one example of presidents don't know. But and sometimes, like you said, you know, sometimes they fake don't know and sometimes they really don't know. And Truman is just a dramatic example of where someone doesn't know. But the other thing they do is presidents lie. And that's a hard thing to really kind of come to grips with, but we have to. And the point in history that I take, I mean, we could talk about the JFK assassination, which is really a coup d'etat to anyone who is honestly looks at the information. It was a coup d'etat to remove JFK and replace him with Lyndon Johnson. There's no other way to look at that. Or we could look at 9/11, but we won't even get into that. We can look at Fast and Furious, Iran-Contra, CIA drug smuggling, all this stuff. It's well documented over and over again. The extent of the lies at the highest level are undeniable. But I drive my point home with an example where we have a really good documentation trail of it, and that is the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So you and I are old enough to kind of remember that history, but a lot of people aren't. The Gulf of Tonkin was the, at least was touted as the precipitating event that drew the United States into the war with Vietnam. And the spin was, oh, these North Vietnamese, they're attacking our ships. What else can we do? We have to fight back. That they're attacking our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. We have to fight back. And that's what starts the Vietnam War. We now know through released documents, released just in the last couple of years, that that was a complete fabrication. We even have the transcripts and or the audio recordings, I don't remember which, of Lyndon Johnson plotting out, okay, well, how can we make it look like they attacked us and all the rest of that? Mm-hmm. So my point really is not so much that that happened, because that won't surprise people. But my point and my challenge to you is, if someone was to read any of the dozens and dozens of books that were written about the Gulf of Tonkin incident before the last couple of years, before this information was released, they'd find a paper trail that says, gee, there's nothing but good and honorable people trying to do their best, trying to uphold the values of the United States, the values of the Constitution, trying to do the right thing. And we know that the way the sociopathic system works, whether in corporation or whether in government, is that most of us, 95, 98% of us, are good people who do try and do the right thing. But it only takes a few people who are willing to compromise their values or justify their values with this end justifies the mean mentality, which is at the root of sociopathic thinking. That's all it takes. So can we really believe that the presidents are the good guys trying to do the right thing for the country? And if we doubt that, as I do, does that maybe put a completely different spin on how we have to contemplate disclosure, how we have to prepare for disclosure, and what we can expect from disclosure?
Okay. You raised a number of points. Let me do a few of them one by one. Okay, number one, Truman was vice president. Big difference between vice president and president. So I will admit that anybody can be out of the loop except for the president of the United States. The vice president doesn't have to know. The secretary of defense doesn't have to know. The president has to know constitutionally.
JFK didn't know that they were plotting that there was a plan afoot to assassinate him so that LBJ can be replaced. He doesn't know that. Truman doesn't know that Project Paperclip is underway and that the way they run the game on Project Paperclip, right? They go and tell him, is like, you know, there's just a few of these Nazis we need to bring in, you know, and then what they do is they just bring in scores and scores of Nazis, and they spread it to intelligence and not just the space program and the rest of that. He's never let in on any of that. The point about the shadow government, I think, is too strong to deny.
Well, that's where I disagree, because if you take a look at the issue, you've had 13 presidents have dealt with this subject. They've all done exactly the same thing. I mean, whether Republican, or there's been six Republican, seven Democratic administrations, they've all done the same thing. And this is getting into the conspiracy thing. When I went to the library, I would look at, because I couldn't find any UFO documents, I spent a lot of my time just reading the material of the oral histories. And I'd read like Cheney's and Rumsfeld and all this stuff. And I would read all these things, you know, these different issues that happened, and I'd read their explanation and they're being interviewed. And I go, well, that kind of makes sense. What I would distinguish is between people who are sort of good and people who think they're good. I do not believe that anybody in the government thinks I'm an evil guy. I'm an evil guy and I'm going to do evil stuff. Everybody thinks they're saving the world. And this goes to Al-Qaeda. This goes to the story of the guy in Florida doing all these shootings. And then he's in the bathroom and he says, is there any blacks in here? I don't want to shoot any blacks. They've had a bad thing. So here's this guy justifying in his own mind. I'm the right guy. I'm paying back the Americans for dropping all these bombs. I believe that everybody, whether you may be totally deluded as to what you're doing, but you think you're saving the world. It may be George Bush thinking that all the money, if the Bushes have all the money, that'll save the world, or Trump, or, you know, it may be deluded. But everybody, I believe, actually thinks they're saving the world. They're actually doing the right thing. I don't really believe that anybody thinks I'm the evil guy and I'm going to do this evil stuff and, you know, whatever. They're going to justify it by some other reason, that survival of the fittest, or we've got to, you know, create this thing. And the vast majority of American military policy is based on these deceptions, where you're running these type of things that are trying to create, you know, you're breaking laws all over the place. But it's the old idea is sometimes you've got to crack a few eggs in order to get things to go. Like even Obama goes back to Nagasaki. Or Hiroshima, whatever one, a couple weeks ago, and he still refuses to apologize for dropping the bomb. We still, the Americans still think this was a great thing to do, to drop and melt 100,000 people into the sidewalks. And so when those guys dropped that atomic bomb, they landed in the Philippines, they were given awards, and they lived honorable and noble lives thinking they'd saved the world. And the Americans still think they saved the world by killing 100,000 people. On the outside, you look and say, well, this is evil. I mean, if there is such a thing as evil, this is about as evil as it gets. So I make the distinction between people who are doing bad things and people who think they're doing bad things. Everybody thinks they're saving the world, and I don't care who it is. And the other thing is this thing with lies, this thing about the deception of lies, is that's how the game is played. The Canadians said, we're told, it was the most highly classified subject in the United States, which makes it known as a waived, unacknowledged special access program. It's waived from Congress, congressional oversight. There's only a couple of people in Congress who are told about these programs, and if it's the highest class, this will be one of them. They're told orally, that's it. Just given notification the program exists. It's unacknowledged, which means that even the existence of the program is unacknowledged, which means if somebody comes to you and you're in this program, you have to lie and deny the program exists. Otherwise, you're going to jail. It's unacknowledged. You are not allowed to acknowledge the program. So people are given permission inside the U.S. government to lie. That is the way you do it. Otherwise, you're going to get like the situation with Hillary Clinton right now. She's in a situation where she's not releasing classified information. She's just been accused, and she's in this criminal investigation, of mishandling classified material. She has 147 FBI agents working on her case, according to the FBI director. So nobody wants to get in this thing. People are very, if you're a patriotic American, you've got this, you've taken an oath. It's the old expression, those who speak do not know, and those who know do not speak. If you are in this highly classified program, you're there because you're trusted and you're not going to release the material. So you're going to lie about this sort of stuff, and you're going to create situations in U.S. foreign policy where you make it look like something's happening in order to get something done and overthrow a government or whatever. You're using deception. That's how it works. You know, it's a game of deceiving the opponent. And it's because we have this separation idea, what I call a left brain separation idea. It's that we're the good guys, we're the Americans, we're the good guys, and the Russians are bad guys. So that the ends justifies the means. We can do whatever we want in order to lie to them, cheat, get in their country, do whatever we can in order to do it because we're going to save the world. We have to do this to save the world. And that's my justification of the way the thing works in the government, is you really can't believe anything anybody's saying because it's classified. So people will come out and say, oh, there's no program. And I'd say, well, if you were told, would you be telling us? Well, no, because it's classified.
Grant, in your book, The Clinton Storybook, you have a pretty amazing chapter on Lawrence Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Initiative. Now, for folks inside of the UFO community, I think they're familiar with a lot of the work that Lawrence Rockefeller and the interest that he had in this field. But I think for a lot of folks, both inside the UFO community and especially outside of the UFO community, there's always been this kind of knee-jerk reaction and association with Rockefeller and New World Order and secret government and all of that stuff. And one of the things I think you do an excellent job in your book is dispelling that image by just exposing the facts and what we really know about this guy. And more importantly, revealing all the hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents that you discovered through your Freedom of Information request about the Rockefeller Initiative and Rockefeller's interface with the Clintons on trying to unravel this UFO mystery. So please tell us about that.
Okay, well, Rockefeller was one of the sons, the famous sons. Nelson was his brother and David's his brother. And he's the guy, I always identify him as the guy with the philosophy degree from Princeton. He wanted to be a lawyer. He was going to be a lawyer, and then he pulled out, didn't want to finish the law degree, decides he's going to do the philosophy degree, becomes a big environmentalist. In fact, he's the guy who controlled all the land in Wyoming. And then when just before he died, he actually gave all the land back to the government. And he actually took all the Rockefeller cabins down piece by piece, disassembled them to the great displeasure of the rest of the Rockefeller family, and gave this stuff back to the American government. So he's a different than the rest of Rockefellers. He had Eastern Airlines, he owned that thing. So he did the business thing, but he had this great interest in paranormal phenomena, not just UFOs. He had all sorts of other interests. And he got into the UFO thing, and he was financing a lot of the major UFO people. For example, when John Mack came under attack by Harvard University, he financed his defense.
Explain who John Mack is real briefly.
Well, John Mack was psychologist at Harvard University who wrote a book on alien abduction and made it known that he believed this and came under attack to be his tenure pulled at Harvard University.
So Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs are doing this regression work, this hypnotic regression of people. And they're saying, hey, man, these people are telling us that they were really abducted and they came in contact with alien intelligence. And it's a really important thing. And John Mack runs into Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs at a Manhattan cocktail party. And he hears the story and he kind of says, guys, I'm a Harvard psychologist. I've talked to people and they have all sorts of fantasies and illusions and you just don't know what you're doing. But he's curious enough to say, well, let me investigate this for myself. So he starts talking to these same people and he says, wow, you know, as a trained psychotherapist who's aware of kind of how people operate when they are fantasizing, when they are delusional, these people are not. He comes to the conclusion pretty quickly that these people are telling the truth. And then he also, at the same time, comes in conflict a little bit with Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, because he says that the message that I'm receiving is that this is a spiritually transformative experience as well as an alien contact experience. So now back to your point, Rockefeller backs John Mack because he's a Pulitzer Prize winning author and he's just a superstar academic at Harvard, thinks he's invincible until he goes out and publishes this stuff on UFO contact, and suddenly he's about to lose his job and he's called into the board by surprise. But fortunately, he has a fantastic attorney there that really does a great job of standing up for him. And who pays for that attorney?
Yeah, Rockefeller. And it was Danny Sheen who was the attorney. And the way they actually turned it around is they said, okay, we're going to have disclosure. We're going to call witnesses. And if you want to play this game, and Harvard figured, we're not going down this road. We're going to have this big like kangaroo show trial. And we're going to have all these witnesses at Harvard University on whether this phenomenon is for real. And they just sort of folded the tent when they realized this was going to happen. But John did have this great difference, this seeing it as a spiritual thing. And in one debate with Bud Hopkins, he said, maybe our disagreements has more to do with us than the subject. It tells more about us than it does about what's actually going on here. So he saw it completely differently. Hopkins was an atheist, and John Mack saw this as a completely different, going down a completely different road. He was very much, he even had some of the One particular case that I refer to sometimes in my lecture, where he has the guy and he's regressing him, and he says, "Is this the first time you met this being?" He said, no, I was like 27. And that was the first time? No, I was 9. And is that the first time? He said, no, I was in my past life. And he said, really? And this alien was actually in his past life. And so you get this sort of thing where, Hopkins and Jacobs would just shut the whole thing down. And for example, Bud Hopkins used to tell people, I know two people that were with Hopkins, where it would get into the spiritual type stuff. And then he would say, maybe you should go to Leo Sprinkle. He's more sort of down your alley. You work better with him, because he just didn't want to deal with this. Even when Mary Rodwell tells a story, I always maintain that there really are no abductions. That if you get a person in a deep trance and you say to them at any point in the past, did you agree to be in this situation? Everybody will say yes. This was an agreement they made as they came into life to do this. And I remember Mary Rodwell telling me the story that she met with Bud Hopkins, and she brought this up. And she said, Bud, why don't you ask this question? She said, he didn't answer the question. He just stood up and walked out of the restaurant. He would not even address it and just walked out. So there's this big difference. And John had this spiritual side when he started to explore this. And so he defended him. And he also spent a lot of money funding Colin Andrews, who's another guy who's gone down the spiritual path. In fact, it was Colin Andrews' lecture on consciousness and crop circles where I got my download. And I wasn't into crop circles, but I figured he's this high level guy. And Rockefeller had actually given him the money to hire private investigators to go out and to actually investigate how many of these crop circles were hoaxed. And it was when Colin Andrews came out and said that 80% were hoaxed that nobody in the UFO community would talk to him. They figured, oh, he's working for the other side. He's, you know, he's turned on us and stuff like that. And yet what Colin Andrews will say about those 80% is the ETs or the aliens are causing the 20%, and the 80% that are being hoaxed are also being made by the aliens. The aliens are putting the ideas in these hoaxers' heads. And that was the lecture I heard when I suddenly got this download. And so you only have a few people in the UFO community who are actually doing the consciousness thing. Colin Andrews is one. I'm another. There's Bob Davis, who's the neurologist that works for the Free Foundation. But other than that, everybody's still into nuts and bolts. Everybody's still, you know, standing in the backyard watching lights fly around in the sky and stuff like that, and sort of missing the whole point of what's going on here, this whole consciousness, spiritual aspect that this that goes on. But Rockefeller picked this up.
Let's return to Rockefeller. So that's who Rockefeller is. Tell us how he shows up in the book. And in particular, tell us how you came across this information, because you have some amazing FOIA, again, FOIA, Freedom of Information Request. It's a law in the United States that allows any citizen to petition the government for information about a particular topic. And if you're lucky and they're asleep at the switch, they send it to you. Yeah. And so tell us about your FOIA request related to Rockefeller and this treasure trove that they revealed.
See, as with almost everything in my UFO career, I got dragged into it. I really didn't intend to go there. What happened was Bush is running, Perot is running, and Clinton's running. And he tells, according to what Bud Hopkins told me, he said, whoever wins, I'm going to get UFO disclosure.
This is Rockefeller.
Rockefeller talking to Bud Hopkins.
Who, even though Rockefeller is, like you said, the black sheep of the Rockefeller family, he knows he's a Rockefeller, and he knows that, you know, he can get stuff.
I'm going in the president's office. I'm going to go in the president's office. And then I remember Bud says, I said to Mr. Rockefeller, I said, Mr. Rockefeller, I don't think it works like that. I don't care. I'm going in there, and I'm going to tell the president. I'm going to get this thing disclosed. And so when Clinton wins, he immediately makes his move. And he, because he's a Rockefeller and because he's a big campaign contributor to the Democratic Party, they've got to deal with this guy. And this is where I get in this thing the president doesn't know. Rockefeller never deals with the president, ever. He never gets to the president. He gets cut off at the pass with the office of Jack Gibbons, who is his science advisor.
And hold on, just to clarify, you're suggesting that is a strategy for this idea of plausible deniability. Don't get too close to the president. So the president, in this case, Clinton, has a very intense interest in the topic, but he knows that because he's schooled by people around him that we'll get you the information you need, but you need to have a little bit of a distance, a little bit of plausible deniability with this guy. So that's how this thing is then orchestrated and plays out. So please continue.
There's a scientist, Ron Pandolfi, who I often reference, who was the top scientist in the CIA. And he was supposed to be run the weird desk, all the paranormal phenomena, UFOs, which is interesting because in the CIA, it's called phenomenology. It's not called UFOs. It's called phenomenology, which is what I say now. It's all the same thing. It's all connected. If you know how it all fits together, it's the same thing. So he's the head of the phenomenology department in handling the UFO files. And his words are, the president can't be a player. He basically, and that's what it comes down to, is that if the president has all information, we don't need to be playing with answering questions to people. It's like Bill Clinton described it to Rockefeller when he was at the ranch. He said, this story is like the tar baby. You touch the tar baby, you get stuck to it, then you try to get away from it, and all you do is get more tangled into it. So the Rockefeller can't get to the president. He gets to, they deal with him at the office of the science advisor to the president, Dr. Gibbons. And he starts this comes in, and he's going to give this briefing. He takes this fellow by the name of Dr. Scott Jones, who is a Navy intelligence guy, very spiritual, into knows the consciousness aspect of this whole thing. And they go in to do these briefings, and they relate what they've got. And the only reason I found out about these documents was because somebody else had filed FOA. I didn't realize that this Rockefeller thing was going on. It wasn't until I filed and got the 991 pages, suddenly I realized there was this Rockefeller guy who went to the White House. Nobody knew until after the documents came out that this event even took place. It all took place sort of. Well, I had heard, because I'd been filing FOAs, I'd been to the Reagan and the Carter Library and all this stuff, so I knew the FOIA thing. And then I heard, I didn't even realize that the Office of Science and Technology Policy was exempt when the president's in. That's the only office that you can file with. Otherwise, you got to wait till 5 years after he's out. And I had heard that Bruce McAbee, who's a Navy physicist in Washington, who sometimes had lectured to the CIA at lunchtime and stuff like this, I knew who he was, and I heard he got 500 pages. I went, oh, really? And so I filed, and then suddenly I got these 991 pages. And as I identified in the book, these documents are now missing. You cannot find them. I went to when I started filing after President Clinton left, I filed with the library, and I was looking for these documents to appear in the, and I was getting documents and stuff, but none of these documents appeared. The big UFO file was 900 pages, and none of these documents are in there. So then I filed an actual FOIA on these 1,000 pages that I'd gotten when he was in the White House, and they said, no, we don't have them. And I said, you got to have them. I mean, here they are. And I give them the index.
You said, I have them. You must have them.
That's right. I give them the index with the names and the number of pages and the date and everything like this. And then they say, oh, maybe they're in another file that's marked different and we don't have it. And then they say, well, talk to the National Archives. Maybe they have them. So I go to the National Archives. I file the National Archives. And they said, we don't have them. So I said, this is garbage. And I file an appeal and I lose the appeal. And basically these documents, so the government says nothing's covered up. There's 1,000 pages of documents, which I've got, which are on Steve Bassett's Paradigm website. They're all over the place. And we've got them. And they say, no, we don't have them. They don't say we don't have them. They said, we can't find them. And so this is what happened. I find out with this Rockefeller Initiative. And I start looking at this whole thing, and it's this really intriguing story of Rockefeller who does his first briefing. He goes in at 7:30 in the morning, has this half-hour meeting. This is a little spiel about how he wants disclosure and stuff. And the president's science advisor tries to say, "Okay, we'll do what we can for you. We'll look into this kind of stuff." And on his way out of the office, the first morning when he does the briefing, he stops at the first lady's office. And again, it's like the old thing. I didn't figure this out till last year as to why he stopped at first lady, why she's so important. I knew because when I got the Rockefeller Initiative, there's two documents in the Rockefeller Initiative that mention Hillary Clinton. And you got to remember, she's not in the government. She's the first lady, but she doesn't have an official position in the government. She doesn't have a security clearance, anything of sort of stuff. She's in the document. And the one says, what happens is Rockefeller has two things he's threatening the president with. And if he doesn't get his way, he's going to get he's going to launch these things. One is a letter. It's an official letter asking for UFO disclosure. And I put it in the, it's a draft. I put it in one of the appendixes. And it basically says, this has to be opened up. I want it. And it's because he's such a public figure, this is going to like be big news. I mean, everybody's going to know about Rockefeller. They're going to be asking the president questions. So they did whatever they could to stop him from giving this letter to the president.
Just let me interject from your book. I learned that along with the letter, he is going to publish that letter by way of every major newspaper in the country. So it's going to be in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA. It's going to be in every paper, full page, because he can afford to do that.
Yeah. And the second thing he's going to put in the newspaper is the more damaging thing. And this comes down to this thing, does the president know? The wording says, Mr. President, what do you know? When did you learn it? Have you told Congress? The people need to know, don't try to go it alone. Which is doesn't talk about the Eva Cabal, the Wizard of Oz. It basically says, Mr. President, I know you know. Are you going to tell Congress? Are you going to tell the people? Don't try to go this alone. So he's basically threatening the president. And he basically said, I've got the money to do this. I'm going to put it in every major newspaper. And of course, they go, okay, what do you want, Mr. President, or Mr. Rockefeller? And they basically bend over backwards. Whatever he wants, they're going to do. And that's when they say, well, Mr. Rockefeller, if this thing's as deeply classified as you say it is, and if it's as wide as you say it is, there's no way we're going to get this thing declassified. Give us one single case. We'll declassify that. And then we'll go after the rest of it. And Rockefeller says, okay, good idea. We'll go after Roswell. And that's why in the mid-1990s, the Air Force goes after Roswell. It's not that they want to get back into UFOs. It's not that they want to reinvestigate Roswell. They're forced to do it. The president greenlights an investigation, and the Government Service Accounting Office is also doing an investigation on Roswell, and they're forced to do it. They don't want to do it. And then they put out the first report, and they come out and they say they don't talk about the bodies. Then Clinton forces them to talk about the bodies. They do a second report, and this Air Force is being dragged down this road where they don't want to go. They've gotten out of UFOs in 1969, and now they're getting dragged back into it again, and almost like they're supposed to be the fall guys that are supposed to take the fall for this thing.
But Grant, let's skip ahead, because at the end of the day, they chase Rockefeller away. I mean, is this a story about disclosure? Well, it's a story about a fantastic research project and a fantastic mystery that you unravel and document with all these documents. But here's my read of it. They play him. They put him off. They do the game that they've been doing really effectively for the last 70 years. And he tires, and they convince him that they're earnest and that they're really looking, and they just can't do it. And he goes away, and he doesn't run the ad. He doesn't do that. And he doesn't really get any information at the end of the day.
Yeah. He just gives up. That's the way I look at it. He just sort of gives up. He 1996, he just sort of runs out of, options, and why he doesn't pull off the threats, but he just sort of gives up. I mean, he may have been told indirectly, because the last thing, and this is this thing about the president again knowing, is in 1995, Bill Clinton's losing the election to Dole. The swing voters are all people who are into the ecology. They're into camping and stuff. And he's forced to go to the Rockefeller Ranch. Now he's away from the CIA. So he goes to Rockefeller Ranch for his 1995 holidays. He's yelling at Dick Morris on the phone, get me the hell out of here. I don't want to be here. And he's forced to go camping and horseback riding and stuff that he doesn't want to do. He wants to go to the Hamptons and golf. And he's doing all this kind of stuff. And then Rockefeller does the big briefing. He's got all this material that's provided by Dr. Stephen Greer. He's got hundreds of pages of documents. He sits down and he's going to tell the president. So if the president is all into UFOs, if he wants to know what's going on in this big mystery, he doesn't know what's going on, why doesn't he sit down at the briefing? And Lawrence Rockefeller's woman, who ran all his UFO funding stuff, maintained absolutely for sure the president did not sit down at the briefing. So the question is, if you believe the president doesn't know and he's trying to figure out, why didn't he sit down at the briefing? He was right there in the ranch and he doesn't sit down at the briefing. Only Hillary Clinton sits down at the briefing. And at that point, she says to him in the next morning, according to what Whitley Strieber reporter said, Hillary says to him, now we've listened to you, don't ever bring up the subject again. And he sort of just throws up his hands and he sort of starts financing other studies. He still stays in UFOs, finances other stuff, and he gives up on the Clinton. Now, whether they told him, we can't do anything for you, we're in a box, I don't know what happened, why he gave up. But he basically gives up in 1996, and the story sort of fades away, and they sort of escape this challenge from Lawrence Rockefeller. And the documents sort of end in 1996.
Great. Okay, Grant, last topic, the one that's, I don't want to say the most important, but the one that's kind of nearest and dearest to me, UFOs and spirituality. And we're going to have an interesting time going at this, because you've brought it up a couple of times already in the interview we've had, and you have some very important points, because as you point out, the UFO research community has been very slow to accept the experiencer part of this and the consciousness connection with both telepathy and other psi phenomena, but also the connection with what most of us would consider spiritual phenomena, such as near-death experience, spiritually transformative experiences, and even some of the things that fall in between that, DMT, spirit molecule kind of. You know, when we, I just listened to a great interview again with Rick Strassman, who was on the show, but it wasn't my interview that I did. But, you know, the punchline to the thing is these people go in and they have the DMT experience and they go to the other side and they encounter these beings that are no doubt the same beings. They look like it, sound like it, everything else. And what do the beings say? We've been waiting for you. We're glad you're here, which is something that is very much in line with what you're saying. What I hope we can pull apart in this last little bit of discussion is, to what extent should we look for the similarities and the parallels between the spiritual and the contactee experience? And to what extent should we be cautious about drawing too many parallels between experiences that many would see as dangerous, threatening, or at least unpleasant? And do we really want to draw parallels between those and some experiences that you don't hear that in the near-death experience? What you hear over and over in the near-death experience is the overwhelmingly the experience of love, the experience of connection, the experience of oneness. Okay, so we'll talk about it. So you handle that however you like.
Okay, I'll just sort of give you a synopsis of what I started. And I actually, at the end of the conference, I've been thinking about it, and I'm almost prepared now to say this may not be ET. This may be much more, it's definitely much more complex than ET. If you think this is just straight aliens coming from another planet, you're going to be wrong. But with my main focus in there.
But that's not the issue. Gosh darn it. I get so frustrated when I understand where you're coming from. But I think we're burying the lead when we say that. I was just listening to Jeff Kripal, who I think is an awesome guy, you know, and he and Whitley Strieber just recently published a book, Supernatural, and they come to that same conclusion that we should be very careful about accepting the ET hypothesis because it doesn't really make any sense and this and that. What I see from both the spiritual experience that we understand and try and catalog, like we're just saying, if we go to DMT or near-death experience or out-of-body travel, and we try and study those scientifically, or we try and study psi scientifically, what the overwhelming message to me is diversity, 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 that it's all true. Not that we can funnel it down into one common experience, but that there's a variety of different experiences. And that's my concern when we talk about ET and we say it's not ET. Of course it's ET. Of course there are physical beings. Of course there are probably non-physical beings. Of course, it's all those things and more. They probably come from so many more planets than we can even imagine. And are we moving it in the wrong direction when we try and funnel it all down and say, oh no, it's just one experience. It's phenomenology. And if we don't look at it through one lens, we're going to miss the point.
Let me just explain how I'll maybe handle that later. The way I explain, I start with the lecture is I say, we believe in this physical world. There is no physical world. When you break the quantum physics thing and you go to the dual slit experiment, a particle does not take a position in time and space until there's an observer. They're basically, my impression after 40 years of this and the download and all and I've looked at all the different phenomena. I did the near-death experience. I did the psychedelics. I wrote a whole book on all this kind of stuff, is that there is just consciousness. That's all there is. If we start going down the physical, there is a physical thing, but you need an observer to bring the physical into reality. So you have consciousness that starts to vibrate. For example, I do a lot on downloads, and the one person who got the download said, if it vibrates, it's illusionary. So you get this consciousness type thing, and it will create denser and denser types of physical phenomena. So it's not that the aliens or ETs can come in here, they can create a physical thing. But if you take a look at the free survey, the number one being that is seen is not an alien. It is a human type being. Number two is not an alien either. It's a ball of light. So I say, if you believe this is ET, does a ball of light get up in the morning and eat bacon, eggs, toast, and coffee? That's the number two being seen, reported by 54% or whatever it is of all experiencers. So it starts to say, maybe we're missing this. And one of the questions I always ask experiencers when I talk to experiencers, and I asked Betty Andreasen, who is one of the longest ones. 1946, she had her first experience with her husband. Bob Luca had his first experience in 1946. I say to her, I say, Betty, can I ask you a question? You have the small grays that are operating. Then you have the tall grays. And I said to her, you dealt with the tall gray, and this is the one that talks to you and encounters with you and shows you the love and stuff. The other ones are like little drones, and they're just doing the work type stuff. I said, when you had this being, and I've asked piles of experiencers this question, once I caught on to this, I said, you saw this being in 1946, and now you're like an 80-year-old lady. Did the being ever get any older? She said, no, it didn't. Everybody says the same thing. No, it didn't get any older, but aliens live a long time. Nobody ever says the alien gets any older. And when you get the John Mack thing, you see the alien is in the past lifetime. So you start to the whole physical world thing breaks down to me. It starts breaking down when you start looking at how quantum physics works and this assumption that it's physical. We know for a fact that things aren't solid. If you take a look at, we know, for example, that 99.9999% of the atom is space. And if you go to the...
That's my problem. That's my problem, Grant, with, and everybody does this, and to me, it's the fatal flaw. And you just did the switch, right? So you just said, okay, everything is consciousness. We're dealing in a tiny sliver of that consciousness spectrum that we understand and we call our reality.
The physical world, yeah.
And there's a much greater extended consciousness. There's an extended.
There is just consciousness. There's no level just consciousness.
Well, I challenge that, you know, because at one level to say there's this abstraction, this philosophical abstraction that everything is consciousness. Let's put that over aside. Then let's take the other piece and say, we are operating in a very small frequency of that consciousness that we call our reality.
Yeah.
All indications are that if we were to talk about some kind of hierarchy or put it on some kind of spectrum or map it out just to play that game, if you will, we'd be in a very small, little narrow range, and there'd be this much larger range. But what we want to do then is turn around and say things like 99% is space, that black holes, that dark matter, and all the rest of that. All that goes out the window. If we are going to really take that leap and say that there are these other realms and we're going to map them out, we can't do them from that vantage point that we're talking about. Everything becomes nonsensical. You know, I really appreciate Raymond Moody, even though he talks in riddles so much of the time. Of course, Raymond Moody is the guy who really pioneered the near-death experience research, but as you know, because you've researched it, he was really piggybacking on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who had written the book and had a chapter in her famous book on grief and dying on the near-death experience, but was instructed by her publisher and her colleagues to leave that out. There's enough that you're handling just with what you're doing. Raymond Moody picks up the ball and becomes a bestseller many times over and also pioneers this whole field of near-death experience research. When you talk to Raymond Moody and you talk about what this means and how we understand it, he says something very interesting. He says, number one, it's pre-scientific, which means all our attempts to try and understand it, categorize it, survey it is folly. It's pre-scientific. And the other thing he says is that it will require a new system of logic for us to even to be able to approach it because it's nonsensical. He's not saying that we have to get to another dimension, or we have to understand consciousness or understand the double slit experiment. What he's saying is something very intriguing. He's saying that we do not have in our current consciousness, in our current system of logic and reason, the ability to approach these topics. And I think we want it both ways. I think we want to overthrow materialism, something that you talk about, that I talk about. And then what we want to do is we want to slip materialism back in the back door and start talking like we know what any of this stuff really means. Like we know what ET would even mean, what we know what contact would even mean, or the shamanic experience would mean, or what near-death experience and the contact people have with Jesus Christ, and they have him, they touch his hand where he was on the cross. We don't know what any of that stuff means. So we have a very limited way of talking about that in any meaningful way. But let me just finish my rant. That doesn't mean, and here I kind of take issue with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal, that doesn't mean that we need to kind of take this relativistic position, which says, well, then we can't know anything about anything. It's this weird situation where both are true. We can and should and have to try and figure this stuff out the best we can, but we just have to do it in a way that is unbelievably humble and realizes how crippled we are at really coming to grips with it. And that to me is a huge contradiction, but it's the closest I can come to a real approach to how we need to get into this topic. What do you think, Grant?
As much as it annoys you, this other thing, what annoys me is when we say, well, we don't know anything. I mean, this is the biggest game in ufology. It's like we have 1,000 sightings every year. And then we say, we don't know what's going on. We have no idea what's going on. Send some money. We need to do an investigation. And this is garbage. Science does not work by proving things, because you're never going to prove anything to Shermer or any of these other people. It's not work. It's work by working hypotheses. And I have a working hypothesis that works. And I was actually had a conversation with a Dr. Ingo Lambrecht, who works with, trained as a shamanic guy in Africa. He now works with the indigenous people in New Zealand. And we had a one-hour conversation last weekend, and we both have the same, we're going down the same road. And the working hypothesis is that you have a consciousness field, you have this physical environment that we're in, which is we are held in by our left brain. And he was going the same thing. He was saying, yes, this is exactly. And we can reproduce these experiments. We can actually reproduce. You had a guest on who said, we don't know anything about savants. This is absolute nonsense. We can actually produce savant-type abilities by magnetically stimulating the left hemisphere of the brain. And we can create these people to have these savant-type abilities. And it's a working hypothesis that we can... When you start looking at all these things, to me, it's all the same stuff. It's like the way I refer to it is Stephen King, who wrote a lot of his books through lucid dreaming. He has this expression in the Dreamcatchers, SSDD, same shit, different day. It's all the same stuff. And we can do it. And we know how to shut the left brain down. We know how to access these environments. And you to start seeing these parallels. And in near-death experiences, you have the bad stuff. You have the bad experiences where they go to hell. In the psychedelics, you have the bad experiences. In the abduction experience, you have the bad thing. You have all these parallels going through. There is no difference between all. It's all basically the same stuff. And so we have this working hypothesis that to me works, that we can separate all this stuff. And the way I look at it is like Ibn Alexander talks about his experience. He's down in the mud in these experiences. He gets dragged out of the mud by the music, and he moves up and he goes up. And to me, it's not like levels. It's like clear. The water gets clearer and clearer and clearer until you get up. So you have certain things like mediums. Some are good mediums. Some are really good mediums. Just how far can you get in? How far can you shut the left brain down? And the idea of the evil thing is basically something we take in. For example, Hopkins and Jacobs would both say when it comes to alien abduction, it's 100% evil. If you take a look at the free survey and you talk to the people who have these conscious recollections, it's 9%. There's something wrong with the data when the people who are experiencing are saying that it's not evil, and you've got people on the outside who are saying it's evil. To me, it's all basically the same thing. It's how you can access this consciousness, and the more you can access the consciousness, the more you can move into it, the better you can pull this material out, whether you're using lucid dreaming or whether you're using remote viewing, hypnosis. It's when you look at them all, remote viewing. Ask, you interviewed Joe McMonagle, number one. Ask him, how does this work? How does it work? He says, you got to shut down the ego mind. Everybody's saying the same thing. That, to me, it's not a big mystery. We're starting to understand. I cannot bring you an alien. I cannot prove this stuff. But we're starting to understand how this stuff works.
Grant, let me jump in there because I got a bunch of questions. This is a fun part, the funnest part for me. I hear what you're saying about the left brain, right brain. We had an email exchange before the show, and I sent you some data that suggests researchers are saying that that model may not be the best way of thinking about brains, and they aren't really divided to left brain and right brain. But I don't think that totally undermines or really contradicts what you're saying. It's just one is a very simplistic way of thinking about things, left brain, right brain, and another way is saying one part is the logical, rational, and one part is the more creative, expansive part. But I would come back to the same thing. We still have to, if we're going to play this consensus reality game, which is the way I say is what we're talking about right now, we can acknowledge that we don't know what the hell's going on, that I just heard a great quote from William James. I always say it's like teaching a dog algebra, but I like the William James quote even better. William James said it's like a cat in a library. You know, the cat can walk through the library, walk through the aisles of books, but he's really not going to get much out of it. So, but we're going to play the consensus reality game here, you and I are, where we're saying, you can tell me about what you experienced, and I can say, yeah, I've experienced that too, and I know this, and we can compare facts. So let's do that a little bit when we talk about near-death experience. People who have near-death experiences do not have a functioning brain. You know that, I know that. Yet they have a lot of the same kind of conscious experiences, thinking experiences, logic reasoning experiences, and these are recounted over and over again. Oh, I'm here. Why is this happening? Questioning, comparing the color of socks that the doctor has on his left foot and the right foot. Why are they doing this? This is all done without a brain. That would seem to me to really undermine this idea of left brain, right brain, because what they're operating with, the questions that they're asking, the moving from the rational to the spiritual, they're doing it free form now, and they don't have a brain. What do you say to that?
Well, the analogy is always the TV, that consciousness is not in the brain, absolutely not in the brain, but you need a brain to be conscious.
Well, you don't, because these near-death experiencers don't have a brain.
You have to come back into the physical body and relate it through your mouth and through your out there. It's same as you can cause this by other things as well, psychedelics, where you're out there as well and you're experiencing things that are similar near-death experiences you could not possibly have known. That kind of stuff is happening. So the consciousness is outside the brain, but it's still, you need the, in order to have to see the screen, you need a TV set. It doesn't mean that there's a football game going on inside the TV. There's no little players playing inside the TV. The football players are outside. I will agree with that. The consciousness is outside. But in order to translate that, to express that, it has to come through the brain. The consciousness is using the brain. That's why I sent you this thing. Amit Goswami shows it. The idea that materialistic science will have is say that small particles make bigger particles, which make molecules, which make neurons, which make brains. And then suddenly you get enough brain cells, and suddenly consciousness says, here I am. And that's not how it works. It's the other way around. You have consciousness creates a particle which takes a position in time and space. That particle forms a bigger particle, which forms an atom, which forms a molecule, which forms a brain, which has consciousness. Consciousness is all the way down the line.
Let me see if I got what you're saying. So the way you would explain the near-death experience is that there is just consciousness, that's all there is, but there's also this individuated consciousness. So think of the wave or the drop in the ocean. There's just the ocean, but it comes into form as an individual, and there is this individual consciousness. The way this individual consciousness expresses in our physical reality is through the brain, but in this case, when the brain dies, it ceases to exist, is severely compromised in a way that it no longer is a physical reality. You're saying their consciousness experience continues, but it doesn't really manifest until they return to the body, and then they somehow...
You will have the experience. If you happen to come back, you can relate the experience. If you don't come back, you still have the experience, and you die. You go wherever to the other side. So, but we can create that, not with just near-death experiences. We can create that, for example, like with mediums. Mediums pop out and they can be able to pick up this kind of stuff. I was talking to an Emmy Award-winning film producer last year in Ontario. We were talking and I was talking about this thing about how to force this division, and that one of the things you can do is trauma. Now, near-death experience is like trauma, where you separate and you suddenly, you're no longer in this left brain, I'm here, time and space, local causation. As soon as you get out of the left brain, suddenly it's like Edgar Mitchell. It's like, or like a psychedelic experience. It's suddenly like, wow, everything's connected. Everything's alive. I'm out here. The video I sent you, Jill Bolte Taylor, she says she has the left brain hemorrhage. The blood is flooding her thing, and she said, and suddenly it's like a remote control. It shuts off the left brain voice, and suddenly she's out there. She's part of the universe. She's this kind of stuff. So near-death experiences, all sorts of things where once you pop it out. So I had this medium came up, and she was showing us this stuff, and I was arguing this thing that trauma is one of the ways that you can shut this down and put the person out into this reality thing where you realize there's more than just me, the left brain, me, I, local causation, particles and physical world, and you suddenly realize there's another part of the world. And she came out, I said to this guy, let me ask her a question. I said, OC, tell me a story. How was your childhood? She says, oh, it's terrible. Absolutely terrible. She's going on. 13 out of 16 mediums in one study showed that it was childhood trauma, and that forces them into this thing where they're trying to cut off the physical world. They're trying to protect themselves.
That's Julie Beischel's research, right? And she also connects that to other physical problems.
And he didn't believe me. And then he walks around for the next year and he talks to me last week and he said, you know, I talked to everybody. I was doing all these interviews and it's true. It's absolutely true. So that's what I'm saying is the left brain gives us the impression that we're in a world that has got time, it's got space, it's physical. We are the center of the universe.
I'm with you. But the medium, the after-death communication experience, as we understand it, also suggests that those connections are being made with individuated consciousness that persists after death. So when the medium connects with your father, the best we can understand that, and we can recast it however we want, but the best we can understand it is that they are reconnecting with your father. With your father who has this, you can shake your heads. I'd like to hear your counter to this, but every way we've looked at it suggests that that's the way that it is. So I'd love to hear, but I just don't want to hear a bunch of hypothesis or a bunch of kind of.
It's all hypothesis.
It is. But this whole idea of the Akashic records and it's all out there and you can access it is not what we hear.
Okay.
What we hear back is that dad is there. Dad saw you slip something into his pocket at the wake when he was laying in the casket. He saw that, but he also saw when you christened your child last week. And your dad also said, when I had my medium reading and the medium said, I keep hearing your children are not your children or something like that. I said, well, three of our kids happen to be adopted. He goes, oh, that must be it. Your dad really likes that. He's really smiling about that. And he says, you know, that is a connection of what it's all about. We're all connected. There is no separation. My child, your child, it's all an illusion kind of thing. That is an individuated consciousness that is still connected to my life after they have deceased. Mm-hmm. So I'm not just talking about my story. I'm talking about this is every story you ever hear about mediumship. They continue to be involved in our life. So we don't understand what the time dimension is. We don't understand what the connection dimension is. But I just don't see how we can read that data any differently.
Okay. I would agree with you that there is an individual consciousness. Once it gets up higher, then it'll all become the one where it goes back to source. So you have this individual consciousness. Let me give you an example. I worked on this my whole life. My father dies 10 years ago next week. My father, the day before, 2 days before, doesn't tell me, he tells my mother. His father comes to visit him. My mother says, really? He was here? He died in 1956. He was here? No, she said, what did he say? He said, he was just here. That's all you need to know. He never told me. Because he played the agnostic his whole life. Now, the question is that his father who lived 1,000 different lives, or why did he not come back as one of the other 1,000 different lives? He comes back as that particular individual so that my father would know who he is. But it's not he's the father. He's been a thousand different people. He could have come back, but my father wouldn't have recognized him if he came back.
But it's both and. It's both and. That's the problem, I say. It is your father. It was your father. He came back as your father. And the fact that he's has a thousand different lives speaks to the scale that we cannot comprehend, because we are the cats in the library. And we don't understand how you can be a million lives, a million places. When people, I'm not big on the baby Jesus hypothesis and the historical Jesus, but we know right now that there are hundreds of millions of people who are having direct experience, connection with the Christ consciousness. I have my own spiritual connection with Neem Karoli Baba, who, you know, like this is the experience of millions and millions of people who feel like they have a connection with a spiritual person. How does that spiritual entity that doesn't live, it isn't in body, how does that entity divide their consciousness, divide their spirituality to connect with each person? Well, there's two ways to handle it. One is you say, that's bullshit. It just doesn't happen. It's not real. But again, if we really are realistic about the data suggests that there is that kind of intervention, there is that kind of connection, and that these spirit beings do affect people's lives. So how do they do it when hundreds of millions of people are praying to Jesus all at the same time? Well, how does he do it? You know, well, if you're...
Okay, because it's all one, because he doesn't have a left brain that has separation that makes him think that he knows he can connect everything, that we can connect everything as well.
No, the reason he does is the word that you said a minute ago and that you were resistant to, but then you had to admit. It's that there is a hierarchical order to this consciousness that we don't understand. And it might all reduce to all consciousness, like you're saying. But the experience, and again, how if we're honest about studying it, what the near-death experiencers say is that was a higher being. There was a council, and then there was a council above the council. There was this hierarchy. So we can just reject all that and say, oh, well, you know, that's all just whatever people believe or want to believe or fantasy. But this is the best we can do with what they're telling us. If there is a hierarchical order, then we do not understand the nature of that hierarchy. And the further we get up that hierarchy, it becomes more obscured to us. And we have to be really careful about saying, well, it all consciousness, it all rolls back into the ocean or drops. No, there seems to be this huge order that is veiled to us that probably goes a long way towards explaining a lot of these things that are mysterious to us. And until we penetrate that, I think we have to be really careful about being, you know, a little bit too flippant about, well, it's all consciousness. It may be all consciousness, but it looks to me like all the stuff between our reality and that upper echelon level of consciousness, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And ET is there, and demons are there, and spirits are there, and ghosts are there. There's a lot of stuff there, and it's ordered in a way that we don't understand.
I would say that once you get out of the left brain, once you get out of this physical left brain that makes us think that everything's separate, that there's these people, those people, good guys, bad guys, all that kind of stuff. It's all that people in that environment, whatever that environment is, realize what's going on. The video I would get you to do an interview is Dr. Stephen LaBerge, who did the lucid dream research at Stanford. He has a video. It's called Lucid Dream Techniques, and he talks about this whole idea that when you encounter, and they do the same thing in psilocybin research with Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins, when you encounter one of these beings, you may say, okay, I've met a demon, and the demon was there, and I saw this demon, and he was there, and they say, they'll both tell you the same thing. LaBerge will say, you see this thing, and he makes this joke about the Larson cartoon. They have this big ugly bug trying to get in the window, and he says to his wife, Edith, yeah, it's a big ugly bug, but maybe it's a big ugly bug in need of help. And so what they both will teach you is when you see this, when you're in your lucid dream or whether you're in this sort of a psychedelic experience, that if you take the demon and you treat it with unconditional love and you grab it and give it a big hug, it will change from a demon into a positive thing and will give you a message. And that's 40 years of experience. And psilocybin, 20 years of experience, where they're saying, you may think it's that, but you can translate it that we want to bring that separation. We want to say there's good guys and bad guys, so we move it into this other world. Now, I don't deny in that other realm where you're getting clearer and clearer water, the higher you get up, the more complex it gets. It's more complex than we think, but we're not totally stupid. I think we start to understand how this works outside. It's the physical, it's this left brain that keeps us in this idea that everything's separate, that there's you versus me. And the other one is, we had another example where you had, we talked before years ago about Dr. Michael Newton, who does 7,000 regressions, and he has the guy who has the demon show up in the middle of the office, and the guy saying he's here, he's a real fundamentalist preacher. And so Newton says to him, well, what do you mean? You say the devil's here? And he says, yeah, he's right in front of you. Can't you see him? And the guy's freaking out. And he said, he's right there. He says, well, what's he look like? And he describes the devil and stuff. And he says, well, what's he look like from the bottom? He says, well, it's kind of wispy. So Newton says, well, take a closer look. Who is it really? And then he takes the closer look and says, ah, it's my spirit guide. And he came to teach me a lesson about I'm preaching hellfire and damnation to people, and this is my payback and stuff like that. So it's this idea that you may see Jesus in the outside world or in this environment, but are you seeing the Middle Eastern Jesus? Are you seeing the American Jesus with the blue eyes? So we take all this kind of stuff, and I'm not denying that this is all out there, or that my father out there, or my grandfather comes and he can understand and he can see in this world, because he doesn't have the left brain that makes him think that everything's, he knows everything's together. I believe you get absolute knowledge the minute you die.
Right, but at the same time, but let me jump over to the other side, because at the same time, there isn't really your grandfather. I mean, there is and there isn't. He's a wave in the ocean, but it's still just an ocean. So we keep jumping back and forth, right? So your grandfather is there, but we don't understand how your grandfather can exist individually beyond. And then, like you said, also be spread across 1,000 other lives in his soul group or his path, if we want to start using those words. Do you see what I mean? How it all just becomes, we're constantly flipping back and forth between saying, well, the demon isn't really a demon. The grandfather isn't really a grandfather. It's a manifestation of that consciousness through a certain path in order to give you what you need on your journey. I mean, it all starts sounding impossibly kind of strange to really sort out. You know what I mean? So the demon isn't your demon. Your grandfather isn't really your grandfather.
Yeah, in that world, it's like the lucid dream. You had the lucid dream and you go flying. I mean, did that really happen? I mean, it's like as real. You have that where it's called, to me, it's called template reality, where once you're in the lucid dream and you can control it, you can talk to higher self, you can ask questions, and you can control the environment, and you can produce whatever you want to produce. It's the left brain that makes us think that everything's separate, that there's a physical world, that all this stuff is going on, and
right,
that things have to be individual.
Switch that around for 1 minute. I mean, because that's what always gets me about that. And what's got me about the Crapple thing is, like, as if this reality is real. This reality isn't any more real than that other reality. So I think we have to be very careful with the kind of the style of language we use, because we always say, you know, in the lucid dream, you can create this. You know, it's like, well, what does that say about this world? That this world is somehow different? How would you explain how this world is different? This world cannot be any different, because, as you said, there is only one consciousness. There is only one formation of the way this stuff happens.
Because we have a left brain that makes us think that we're independent, that we're ego, we're the center of the universe, everything's separate. And that was the big debate between Bohr and Einstein. Einstein had the view, we are separate particles just bouncing around, particles banging into each other. And Bohr said, no, consciousness is the base of this thing. The material, or Heisenberg said, materialism is an illusion, and that it's all connected, it's all one. And Einstein said, no, it's particles, it's separate things. And it's that left brain that gives us this impression. And it is no more real. We're deluded as to what's going on. It's like the alien Chandler Bashar said, when you go to sleep, you actually wake up. And when you go to wake up, you actually are going to sleep. And it's that idea. So I call it the template reality, that once you break that connection with the left brain, whether it's through near-death experiences, psychedelics, meditation, you know, any of these kind of things, you break it, you suddenly, they immediately say, oh, I realized I'm connected. Everything's alive. Everything's one. And they go into that world. So if you're in that world, yes, then you can see what's going on in the world. You have this ultimate knowledge. It's just, we're so captivated by believing that we're separate, that there's a physical world and all this kind of stuff. It holds us in here. And once you break that connection, whatever you're using, whatever technique you're using, once you break that connection, you realize this oneness and everything's connected, and that you have this sort of realm of all these people living in there. So the beings, the aliens, or whoever you want to call it, that's their world. For example, people will say, I wasn't abducted, but I had dreams. And when you talk to an alien channeler, they'll say, that's why we come to you in dreams, because now you're living in our world. That's the world they live in. So they're not captivated by this thing. Same thing I talk about implants. If you take a look at Roger Lear, who did the implant research, he removed 17 implants. He was asked, what's the common element between all abductees? And he said, they're all right brain creative people, and all implants are on the left side of the body. The right brain runs the left side of the body. Left brain runs the right side of the body. So if that's true, and that's one of the questions I asked Free in this phase four to find out, are all implants on the left side of the body? It's very significant because they're affecting the right brain. They're not dealing with the left brain. They're dealing with the right non-local. The right brain, once you cut off the left brain, the right brain understands non-locality. It understands everything's one. It connects into that sort of thing. And you can do the same as a spirit. You can figure out what people are doing, and you can see what's going on, and you have this sort of ultimate knowledge by tapping into the materials there. The only reason we don't access, it's there. Everybody has the access. It's that left brain that's shutting us and creating this world that Einstein believed in. There were local causation. That's all you can have. There's time and space. You can't go faster than the speed of light. And you can see all these things are defying it, that something's wrong with that worldview.
Grant, final question. Can't tell you how much I appreciate your time, and just the information is just fantastic. So let's kind of move towards the end with this. You know, you are super plugged into the UFO community, well-respected as a researcher. And as you said, you're one of the few people who are out there trying to make these connections between the UFO experience, the contactee experience, and what we understand to be spirituality, psi, phenomenology, to use your CIA thing. What do you see happening within the community in terms of that trend? Is that a trend that you think is going to continue? Is it going to bear fruit? Are people coming along with it? What are your thoughts?
No, it's actually going the other way. I was surprised when Ray Hernandez told me that really has gotten very bad reaction. MUFON doesn't want to touch it. The big conference in Phoenix really didn't give them an invite for some of their people to come. And I said, are you serious? They're not going this? And the attitude that the UFO community would use is, well, these people just believe they've had these experiences, which is kind of stupid, because the skeptics believe they're right. The people who are making the criticisms believe that they have – everything's belief. It all comes down to belief, and this is crazy. It's like these are the people you got to watch, the people who are the interacting with whatever this phenomena is. The only people you can listen to. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. But it really is, seriously, there is almost nobody. There's a lot of people in the UFO community who use the word consciousness, but they really aren't doing. They're still into this, because the scientific community is running the show. Everybody in the UFO community is into this thing. Even Free's into this thing. I mean, how many PhDs they've got. Everybody's into this Rodney Dangerfield thing. We're the Rodney Dangerfield of all sciences. We need some respect, and people will bend over backwards, lie, do whatever they got to do to try to get science to come on board. They ain't coming on board. The National Academy of Sciences is only 4% of people in the top 2,000 scientists in the National Academy of Sciences who believe in any sort of paranormal phenomena. Only 7% have any experience in God. Forget them. We have to do this ourselves. We cannot try to appease them, because they're the ones that are holding this thing back. They have this materialistic worldview that they are not going to change. You and I are different, because we're not scientists. We don't have any vested interest. We're not going to lose our grants. We're not going to lose our job. We can say whatever we want. But these people are in this box that they cannot get out of this box, and they are not going to change. And so it's totally pointless to try to appease them. But the main people in the UFO community are still trying to appease these people and think that, you know, if we, like, for example, Hillary Clinton brings up this UAPs. Oh, then the nomenclature's changed. It's UAPs instead of UFOs. I know the people are behind that. And I said to them, I mean, are you serious? Do you think scientists are that stupid that they're suddenly, because you call it UAPs, they're going to say, oh, it's not UFOs. Okay, we'll study it. They're not going to study it. Forget it. You've got to go down this road and figure out what it is and figure it out yourself. And they're not coming along, as far as I'm concerned. The number one holdup in UFO disclosure is science. It is this materialistic worldview that says this is garbage. These people are crazy. You can't do this. And that's why I say when there's a disclosure, when it actually gets disclosed and you feel it, you suddenly realize that aliens are telepathic, this gets confirmed. I mean, Shermer's going to be ready to jump off the bridge and people are going to be taking numbers to jump off the bridge because everything they believed is going to be wrong. That's the big thing that'll happen, but not until there's disclosure and there's no way you're going to convince science. You know that. You've talked to enough of these atheists and real hardcore scientist type people. You're not going to convert them. You can talk till you're blue in the face. They're down that road and they're not changing. And that's part of the thing about, I talked to you about the left-right brain thing, is this whole idea that there's not just two brains. According to Gazzeniga, who took over for the Nobel Prize research, he said there are thousands of modules. There are all these different modules, the visual center and the audio center. And there's what I call, that I push down their throat all the time, is this thing about the interpreter in the left brain, which is this thing where when the story becomes inconsistent, this is where I say skepticism comes from. When the story becomes inconsistent, somebody says, oh, there's aliens or there's telepathy. It makes a hole in the wall, and this left brain interpreter, and this is scientifically validated by Gazzeniga's split brain research, where they got these patients who've had the corpus callosum cut, and you can talk to either side of the brain. It's been confirmed that as soon as there's an inconsistency, the left brain, this what they call this, the interpreter or the storyteller, which I call a pathological liar, will actually just make up a story. They'll tell the right brain something. They'll say, get up and go for a walk. And the guy will get up and go for a walk. And then when they talk to the left brain, which is the verbal center, they say, why do you get up and walk? Of course, the left brain, because the brains are separated, has no idea why the guy got up and walked, but it will always make up a story. And what Gazzeniga said, and this is, comes down to skepticism, once the left brain makes a story, it will never change the story. It will hold to it and then make other stories to defend the story it had made. And that's what's happening in skepticism, is you have that left brain, the left brain rational analytical. And if you even have this neurosurgeon who did the split brain research where he talks to the left brain and he says, well, I can't remember the guy's name, but anyway, he asked the left brain, is there a God? And the left brain says, no. And then he quickly asked the right brain, is there a God? Yes. And that's the thing. The left brain is this atheist thing. It's the rational analytical, believes in separation, doesn't believe in oneness. And in that left brain is this story interpreter who keeps it. So when you get these skeptics, you're not going to convince them because this left brain storyteller has filled the hole in and they're not moving off that. They believe there's this rational analytical. They've figured it out. And it's not. There's this thing actually in the brain which is proved, which is making up stuff. It's making up stories. And you'll never hear a neurologist talk about that because it sort of sinks the whole idea that you have this sort of brain that was formed by physical and this just this sort of epiphenomena of consciousness coming out. It gets, when you start looking at the actual brain thing with 1,000 modules and the interpreter, this is so much more complex. And then you start trying to explain thousands of modules all working together as one inside the brain, all knowing what they're going to do, what they call the binding problem. You want to say that you want to get driving neurologists nuts, ask them about the binding problem. How do these 1,000 modules all work as one together to put this together to create this consciousness? They don't want to touch that. They don't want to touch the left brain interpreter. They want to touch the binding problem. They just want you to believe, and everybody goes along with it. Oh, there's just a brain. It's just one brain. It's not two brains. It's just one brain, and it's just no big deal.
The binding problem goes hand in hand with the regress problem, right? It's like, so this is the part that knows how to organize. Well, where's the part that knows how to organize the organization? And where's the part that knows how to organize the organization's organization? And, you know, infinitely regress. So Grant, tell me this, you know, the book again, folks, our guest has been Grant Cameron. His new book is The Clinton UFO Storybook, Extraterrestrial Politics in the White House. How has this book been received? I'm sure you've heard from Clinton, Hillary Clinton supporters as well as detractors. What are people telling you about your take on the real possibility of seeing some movement in the political front on the issue of UFOs?
Actually, you'd be surprised. I have no idea. I don't really watch the book. I don't follow it. I know some of the people inside the UFO community, like Steve Bassett, who's the big lobbyist, is very excited because he's been pressuring Podesta and Hillary. Other than that, I haven't watched how the book. I just move on to the next subject. I put it out there. I logged it, and I came across a big story at the conference. This is a story that Paul Hillier told, and I'm busy working on this. I'm going to try to put out a major article or maybe even a small Kindle book, where I'm going to identify exactly where the cover-up is taking place. And I should maybe tell the story because it's an interesting. It was told by Paul Hillier, who was the former Minister of Defense in Canada. I'd never heard this story. I've known Paul for 40 years. I've never heard him tell this story.
Since you're going to tell the story, Grant, back up and tell us where you heard the story, you know, just the kind of the details that we would need.
Okay, this story happened at the Consciousness, Cosmic Alien Expo in Brantford, Ontario. And what they had there is they had a panel of UFO researchers, and then they had a panel of reporters and people doing PhDs who were going to ask questions. And so everybody made their testimony and their best evidence. I brought up the top secret memo. I brought up about John Podesta saying there are classified documents that can be declassified. That there's no brainer. This is for real. This is they're covering up this thing. And then at the end, the reporters asked questions, and it was Paul Hellyer, who was one of the members of the panel, who, as I said, was the former Minister of Defense in Canada, the former Minister of the Department of Transport, and was the Deputy Prime Minister under Pierre Trudeau in the 1960s. They started asking him questions about, did you know when you were in the Defense Department? And Hellyer said, I didn't know. If I had asked for it, I could not have been refused the data. But I didn't know and didn't ask, so I was never told. Then he stated he had gotten a call from a man who wanted to he was dying of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and he had a story he wanted to tell. And the man had chosen that Paul Hellyer was the man he was going to tell the story to. And the guy was the former head of emergency management in Canada. And so Paul didn't go at first. And then the guy that was the passing the messages phoned up Paul and he said, you better get there. He's about to go off the cliff. So Paul contacts this guy. And the guy tells him, head of emergency management in Canada, says, the Americans briefed me. I was told what was going on. And I was actually taken to Area 51. And I was shown a craft. And it was allowed to go inside the craft and look around. So that was all that Paul told in his story. But it basically shows a number of things. And that is, number one, if they're briefing somebody in Canada and they're not briefing the president, that is highly unlikely that they're briefing people in Canada. The other important thing, and this is where I got going, is that this guy's the head of emergency management. This is one of the guys, if you look at it, this is one of the guys that has to be briefed. Because when this thing goes south, they have to have a plan. There's no way they could have a plan if there's suddenly a crash or something happens they can't control. And I had written my website is presidentialufo.com. On my website, if you go to and I'd written this in 2009, I wrote a couple of articles that were related to this. 2009, I talk about the Johnson administration. And I talk about how there's a Kecksburg crash. And John Podesta actually files an FOIA with a reporter, Leslie Kane, on this thing. They take it to court. They're trying to get the NASA documents. On my website and the Johnson site, I actually detail the fact that all the main people that would have been there, Joint Chiefs of Staff, the science advisor, all these people, governor of the state of Pennsylvania, all show up at the president's ranch the morning after the crash. The guy he meets with, the first meeting, the 30-minute off-the-record meeting, the first day he gets back to the White House, is with the head of FEMA, the head of it was called emergency planning at the time. And so here you have this, and one of the phone calls, there was the Blue Book files actually show a call from Code Bluegrass coming and talking as the crash is taking place. He's reporting that material has been recovered, metal has been recovered in Michigan. Code Bluegrass is Mount Weather, High Point, which is the presidential bunker. This is the head. This is where they're going to take the president if there's a nuclear attack. And it is there where these messages are coming. As this UFO is crashing in Pennsylvania, the head of Mount Weather is reporting, and this is where you have all the communication. They have what's called the flashboard, where they're able to communicate with all the different agencies and all the White House and all the different Air Force bases, secure communication that they need this if the government falls apart. So it's the same organization. It's FEMA. And I start looking, and John Alexander, who I wanted you to interview, and I don't know if he's agreed to it yet, but John Alexander had actually confirmed that MJ-12 is a control group, and John Alexander plays the skeptic. And he said, I don't believe it was UFO. I believe it was continuity of government. This is what MJ-12 is about. Same thing. It's FEMA. It's the same organization. You can see that this makes sense when you hear this story. So this is the one I'm working on right now. I'm putting all these connections together about this FEMA connection, that this is maybe where they're actually running this organization, is out of the presidential bunker in West Virginia.
Wow. Great stuff. We'll definitely have to look for that. Okay, Grant, once again, thanks so much for joining us. It's just been incredibly interesting.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate your interest.
Thanks again to Grant Cameron for joining me today on Skeptico. Two questions to tee up from this interview. The first is, do you believe in UFOs? I don't know if that's the right phrasing for that question, but I can't think of any other way to say it. I think the documentation's overwhelming. I've made the case here. Are you convinced? Number two, what do you think of the UFO/ET consciousness connection? Grant and I talk quite a bit about this in the show. Is there just consciousness and everything is in consciousness, including ET and NDE and shamanic experiences? Or is there more order to this consciousness thing that would make that kind of statement incomplete and not a useful way of thinking about what's going on? So there's the question. Michael, you usually transcribe those questions for me in the forum, and I'm sorry to give you such a long one this time, but I know you'll be able to kind of unravel it the best you can. If you'd like to answer the question, if you'd like to join in this conversation, please join me over on the Skeptico Forum. I love to spend time there. I love to hear from people who are listening to the show and get your opinions and trade ideas with you. As I've said so many times, I've learned so much from listeners. That's such an understatement. I mean, the whole show has formed and the ideas that I have formed through this interaction I have with you. And much of that has been with this old-fashioned forum kind of thing. I mean, I get questions on Facebook and, you know, I interact with people through email, but I still find the forum to be kind of a really useful way of recording these conversations and threading them and making them available to not only me, but to other people. So just a little plug to, again, encourage you to join me on the forum if you'd like to have that kind of conversation. It's, of course, free, as are all the Skeptico shows available, download for free, MP3, get them, transcriptions on most of them through the website, SKEPTIKO. Check it out if you haven't already. And as usual, I will, again, encourage you to contact me in any way you see fit. So if it's not through the forum, feel free to drop me an email or connect with me on Facebook. I'll do my best to get back to you. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up, and these projects I'm kind of working on, the video stuff takes a little bit longer, and I just don't like to get too bogged down on that kind of grind of having to turn these things out every week. It just becomes too much like a job, and that's not what I want to do. I want to get in touch with how this whole experience helps me grow and makes me better at connecting with all the people in my life, which includes you, the Skeptico audience. So I'm trying to pace myself so I can stay in it for the long term, and that's what I plan to do. So with that, we'll wrap it up. As I just mentioned, I do think I have some good shows, so stick around for those. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.